I'd like to call this meeting of the March 16th St. Urho's Day session of the Legacy Funding Committee to order. And I don't think we have a quorum yet, so we won't. We don't. Well, we'll figure it out. If we wait on the minutes just a little bit, and we'll begin with a funding request by the Southern Minnesota Children's Museum. Just for everyone's knowledge today, as you've seen on the agenda, we have four requests, and we'll try to keep these to about 10, 15 minutes at the most. And then we do have a couple of bills to consider, the more lengthy one being the Lessard Sam's Heritage. The plan is to begin that in this session. Then we, of course, have floor session this afternoon. We'll go to that. And then likely come back here 15 minutes after floor session ends to continue with the Lessard Sam's and hopefully be all done before 6 o'clock tonight. That's the goal. And we will be reconvening in room 10. And now we have a quorum, so before we start with the Children's Museum, let's take care of that.
The minutes, Mr. Chair.
Approval of the March 9th. Representative Heintzman has moved approval of the March 9th minutes. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes have carried. Okay, now, Mr. Olson, would you introduce yourself or Representative Johnson? I guess we'll let you start it off.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for hearing this request. And I'd just like to introduce Peter Olson, who's the director of the Southern Minnesota Children's Museum, which is in the process of redeveloping a site in Mankato that is developing a very strong regional asset that involves a lot of private participation, but also really gets after working with children from across the community and working really well with a lot of people interested in making sure that all kids in Mankato and the region have an opportunity to learn and develop. And so I'll let Mr. Olson explain the request.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And Mr. Olson, welcome to the committee. Make your presentation, please.
My name is Peter Olson. I'm the executive director of the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota. I'm going to take you through a really quick PowerPoint presentation, and then if there's time, I have a two-minute video to share with you. And I brought some special guests here, too, under the desk. I might be able to pass out to you.
So you had your guests under the desk. I was a little concerned.
They're waiting to be revealed. The Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota respectfully requests a $600,000 allocation of legacy funding over the biennium, and that'll be used to complete exhibits that have been started with previous allocations of legacy funding. It's also going to support school trips and curriculum development so we can be a full partner to the school districts. And it's also to follow up on Representative Johnson's point to really make sure all the children who are struggling in our region have direct access to art, culture, and heritage at the new museum. And I'd point out, too, that this image you can see on the screen here is actually a work of art that's in progress by 5,000 children in Mankato and the artist Jamie D'Angelo. Every child in ISD 77, the Mankato School District, created a piece of art in the bottle of a bottle cap. And now it's being installed in this mosaic that's all about caring for your food. So we are Minnesota's newest museum, so I'll take you through a very quick background here. It convened, the original board of directors started it in 2005, and today at opening we still have seven founding board members fully engaged in the board of directors. In 2006, it incepted as a 501c3 nonprofit. In that interim time, we've operated three temporary locations where we utilized legacy funding to prototype exhibit components that are all going to be in this permanent museum. And we did it in a community-engaged fashion. We've had two major legacy fund allocations previously. Now we are finished up building renovations on the new building, and we're going to do the grand opening on May 1st. So here's a picture of the outside of the building. It's about 17,000 square feet. It was built in the 50s by the county. It's on a two-acre lot in the city center of Mankato, fully accessible. We've received about $5 million in funding so far. It's very broad base support, but every penny is really important. And it's really, we're serving all of Minnesota, the surrounding states, and a primary 17-county region. It's a massive region that we serve, about 500,000 people who would use our institution as their main children's museum. This is a brief history of our legacy fund support. The first one of $225,000 really got our process going on engaging the community in the development of exhibits. And then the current one, we've been building exhibits, which you'll see some pictures of. And now we're requesting $600,000 to complete the exhibits. Both the inside ones and about 12,000 square feet of outdoor learning environments. And this here is an image of an art sculpture that's been installed in the exhibit hall. It's called Preternatural Prairie Mirage. It's by artist Liz Miller from Good Thunder, Minnesota. She exhibits all over the country, and a lot of us don't even know about her. And this is her first permanent installation. She currently has a temporary installation up at the Public Functionary Gallery in Northeast Minneapolis. So how our legacy fund works is that we use it to engage the community in the co-generation of their museum. We have over 100 community partners actively working on the building of exhibits. We combine that with museum expertise from the cities. We work with developers and designers from the Science Museum, the History Museum, the American Swedish Institute, all over the place. We have 33 partners that are all targeted on helping the kids who need the help the most. We have about 12 full-time equivalent staff positions. We've prototyped all the exhibits with almost 50,000 visitors over the years. And we're projecting to have at least 50,000 annual visitors, and from every county in the state, we expect. This is an image of our volunteer sewing crew. So if you don't mind, I'd like to pass out a few handhelds here. Maybe Representative Johnson can help. These are all hand-sewn by this local team. We have chickens that are going to be in our Grow It Gallery exhibit. We have lots of produce. We have corn. We have soybeans. They're all in these interactive exhibits where children pretend to be farmers. They pretend to be producers. And they're connecting with these really diverse, interesting materials by way of all these handhelds. I'd like to point out one real neat thing. You can see the second woman from the left there, that's Kathleen Michelson. We came in contact with her as the CFO of the Minnesota Humanities Center. That's where our legacy funding is channeled through. And Kathleen is retired from the Humanities Center and in her spare time now is volunteering as our lead sewer. So we have a lot to thank of the Humanities Center, including our number one sewer. So this is a list of all the exhibits that are being currently built, and this is a picture of our exhibit hall under construction. That barn stage last week hosted Education Commissioner Concelius when she had a listening session with about 500 educators and community members in Mankato. I'd also like to point out that 1917 Little Giant Sod Buster. That's an actual artifact that's been donated to the museum. It's going to be pushed back up against the wall like it's driving out of this giant ag mural. And children can actually get up on the sod buster and drive the or turn the steering wheel. It's one of 500 original tractors manufactured in Mankato. There's about 500 of them about five of them in existence today. I'd also point out just the names of our exhibits evoke the story of southern Minnesota. Our museum really is about a sense of place and cultural identity, and it's a direct result of growing up, becoming of age as a museum during the age of legacy funding that we're able to do this. Then we're planning a bunch of really neat exhibits outside. We're going to have a real farmyard with live animals. Kids are going to be planting vegetables. We're going to be interpreting on the rich historical geology of the southern Minnesota River Valley. And we are very proud to have a ribbon of Dakota art culture throughout the entire museum campus. We're working with Grace Goldtooth and Gwen Westerman and a bunch of other Dakota folks to be able to do that.
Mr. Olson, I assume the farmyard is contiguous with the Children's Museum?
That is correct. Yep. You can see it's going to be in this blank spot right here. So I'd just like to thank you all. Point out one of our marquee exhibits here. You can see it's the centerpiece of it. It's the Mankato Clinic Tree of Forts, and it's a big three-story climber. It's being made with about five different community partners, and is really exemplifies how when we come together, we can really accomplish something pretty cool. And if you don't mind, if we have time, I have just the quickest here little video.
Hello, welcome to the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota. I'm Peter Olson, and I get to work at this amazing place.
Oh. Maybe not. Well, I'm not exactly sure where it went. Here. Oh, here it is.
Welcome to the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota. I'm Peter Olson, and I get to work at this amazing place. We're just a month and a half out from our grand opening celebration on May 1st. So how about we go inside and I give you a little tour of how things are coming along. Come on. Now inside the exhibit hall, formerly the bus bar. It's a complete mess, which is a good thing. It's because we're under construction, getting ready for opening. I'm going to give you a little tour here of all the exhibits. Here's the Coughlin Quarry. It's made out of real Mankato Casota stone. It's all about how stone and sand quarries work here in southern Minnesota. Over here, we have a two-story makerspace. It's all about getting hands-on with science, technology, engineering, art, and math. We call it our steam gallery. Right over here, we have our largest indoor exhibit. It's the Gorilla Gallery. It's all about farming today, the diversity of agriculture in Minnesota, and really where our food comes from. Right up here, we have the Mankato Clinic Tree of Forts. It's our tallest exhibit. It has six forts suspended up in the canopy of the tree that children navigate via rope bridges, tunnels, and slides. Over here, we have a very special infant toddler play porch. It's just for 36 months and under, and it's based off of Maud Hart Lovelace's children's book series, Betsy and Tacy. Well, that's about it. There's some other spaces that I won't go into, but you need to come back on May 1st and see it for yourself. 10 a.m., we're going to have our special ribbon cutting. That's Friday, May 1st. We appreciate all of your support, and please help us keep going. Thank you.
I'd be open to any questions.
Mr. Olson. Now, that May 1st, is that this year or was that previously?
It's this year.
This year?
Yep.
What day of the week is that?
It's a Friday. Yep.
Well, I'm guessing that we still might be working here on that day. But anyway, it's good luck on the opening, whether any legislators can get there or not. Does anyone have any questions? Well, and thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Are there any eggs in that, Representative Kahn? The yolks would be soft. Thank you. Our next presentation, overview and funding request by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Whoops. Stop. Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails.
That's right.
Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourselves, please.
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Wafel, and I am the lobbyist for the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Organization.
My name is Tom Ryan. I'm representing the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Commission. I'm an employee of Olmsted County and also involved in the District 6 District Planning Committee as part of our charge today.
During today's presentation, and Tom will be doing about 95% of the talking, we want to share with you all of the work that the Commission has done, as well as the funding requests coming out of Greater Minnesota. We just wanted to mention to you that, because there has been some confusion as we've been talking to legislators, there are two different organizations that work on behalf of Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails. There is the commission, which Tom represents, which is the statutory executive branch commission created by the legislature. There's also the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails organization, which I represent. It used to be the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition, which led to the formation of the commission. We dropped the regional from our name to make it a little bit less confusing, and we help support their goals as well as working on other parks and trails issues. Now I'm going to turn it over to Tom, who's going to tell you about all the great work they've been doing and then the requests we're making from the legislature.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Well, I'll try to be brief, and I'll try to go through these PowerPoints as efficiently as possible, so that if you have any questions, I'll try to address them and answer them to the best of my ability. I would point out page 3 of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission. As Elizabeth stated, we are a commission that was formed by the legislature, and it's an important one, and it's the culmination of a lot of discussion among legislators and eventually the Legacy Funding Committee. And in short, for those of you that are new to this issue, we are obligated on your behalf to try to establish a Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails system, thereby being the third recreational provider in the state of Minnesota. Department of Natural Resources, of course, Metropolitan Council, and then last, but in our view, certainly not least, Greater Minnesota. You can see that one of the things in the spirit of the legacy plan that was written, one of the things that's been very important to us, as it has been to you, is to make sure that we maintain some type of touch and contact with not only outstate Minnesota, but with the citizens that are so involved with recreational in their respective areas. With that, you'll see that there are 13 members that have been appointed, 6 districts. You can see that from the colorful map there. And one of the things that's so important about that is that we need to have our respective districts continue to be partners with us related to what the recreational needs and norms and goals and wishes of those respective districts are. So as a result, the district planning committees are something that have been an important component to this. And you may recall from the legacy plan itself the outreach that was done in preparation for that type of work. As you may recall, the commission was formally appointed in October of 2013, and really we've our charge was to develop a strategic and policy plan. We've done that. It was also our charge to establish boundaries for the 6 planning districts, and you can see those from that icon on a previous page as well. We were also responsible to publish a first-ever system and work plan for regional parks outside the metro, and with our metro partners and the Department of Natural Resources, we've been successful at that as well on behalf of the legislature. And then, last but not least, established initial tools for implementing the plan. And you can see some of those points that are brought out in this slide. The district planning committees, as I mentioned. One that I hadn't mentioned is the evaluation team, and that's on the far right. The evaluation team was part of our original plan related to making sure that the best products, the best recreational products and funding were vetted impartially and in the spirit of what legacy means. And then also, as an aside, but just as importantly, the expectation from our fellow providers at Met Council and DNR, who have been doing this for a long, long time. It was a reasonable request and an important one that it's our hope that the products and the projects that are submitted to us are vetted as thoroughly as possible in the public interest. Certainly an application system. We have been through one application system or one application already. I can tell you that there were some good things about that, and there were also some challenges. And we've been real receptive, we think, to our customers, which would be local municipal agencies, regarding that, and are working through and trying to make that a better product even as we speak. And then, of course, the GoMin GIS web-based initiative as well that we are in partnership with University of Minnesota, Met Council, DNR. And that's really about making sure that we continue to stay relevant with the new ways that people want to find information about where to recreate. The project evaluation process, the E-teams, which is, of course, short for evaluation team, received and vetted nearly 90 proposals in this first application series. And that was a daunting task. And we anticipate that we are going to see many, many more as we go down this road for capacity building. Basically, what happens with that is that they would take the criteria, impartially weigh it. They are former park and natural resource professionals that really have no skin in this game other than that they believe in Greater Minnesota and in righteous and well-done projects. As you can see, the E-team consists of five outdoor recreation experts. They did apply for those positions. Your commission vetted them through their resumes, etc., and then we put them to work. As I mentioned, about 90 proposals came through the door at first, and we released, the E-team rather, released a list of about 20. There were many that were returned, and really, that was really because the information is just so overwhelming, and many of the projects proposed, while still may be very valid, we really impressed on the E-team that they had to stick to the standards. And so there were a lot of them that were sent back with more information needed. Sometimes there was a conflicting, the E-team themselves needed direction from us. In fact, after this first process where they did that, where they evaluated all 90, they came back to your commission with 10 questions that we needed to solve on their behalf so that they could do their jobs better. We meet monthly, as you know. Some of you may be aware, we meet in Sartell. We've invested well over 2,000 hours of commission time to this endeavor on the legislature's behalf, and we broke those 10 questions up in several different meetings. I think it's
worth noting. Representative Kahn, do you have a question?
I think it's when they're finished.
Okay. All right, continue then, please.
Thank you. I think maybe the last bullet on page 5, folks, is that we have determined that funding for the top 15 of the proposals would exceed $18 to $20 million as they stand. We think that strongly demonstrates the need for out-state recreation opportunities, and I'm sure there's many more that would agree with that. Page 6, these are the action items that we're planning on your behalf this year and in 2016. One is that, as I mentioned, refine that application process, make it a little less cumbersome. We have no intention of reinventing the wheel here. There's some good application processes out there already. We took a shot, found that there were some glitches in it, and we're working very hard to improve those. Improving method for managing information, that's very difficult and daunting. However, we're gonna keep grinding on that one, particularly because we're, by all intents and purposes, a volunteer commission, and it's difficult for us to really grind on those things. As is our charge, we are still set and on schedule to finish a statewide system within 3 to 5 years. And one of the things that we need to do as well is educate and coach and really assist these different districts in the application process and in the quality process. Your commission hasn't lost touch with the fact that we are not a ruling agency, but rather a customer service initiative on your behalf. And we take that charge very seriously and keep trying to make our process better. And then we also will select approximately 20 high-quality properties and or projects for the 2016 and 17 funding cycle.
Mr. Ryan.
Please.
I have a question, and Representative Heinzman does as well. Are you, I see you're developing a statewide system. Are you aware where the first state publicly owned park was established in the state of Minnesota?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it wasn't Olmsted County Parks, which of course I represent, I would say it's probably Itasca.
No, it was in Hutchinson, Minnesota, in my district.
Well done, sir. I can assure you I'll never forget that.
It's right down from Twineball State Park.
No, actually,
it was established in 1856 by the Hutchinson family singers when they plotted out the town of Hutchinson. Just a little historical information for you all. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who to direct my question to, but I just am curious. We're looking at, in the previous slide, you're looking at statewide plans and a few of those things. I was wondering where the Cuyuna Regional System or Cuyuna Bike System is in the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, that actually...
Mr. Ryan.
That is actually a DNR initiative, and one of the things that we've been working with our DNR partners about that is separation between. Where we see the commission helping, our commission and Greater Minnesota helping with that, is making connectivity and links and things like that. So I'm really not qualified to answer any further on that one.
Representative Heinzman.
Then I would follow up with, in regard to connectivity, is there anything on the radar? Is there anything coming?
And Mr. Ryan.
There may be in those 90 proposals, sir, but I'm not familiar enough with them all to answer. But I certainly can't get that answer for you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Ryan, Ms. Weffel. Can you tell us a little bit about the discussions that took place to separate you from the DNR and then how to make sure that what you're being asked to do, what the commission is being asked to do, is not supplanting?
Mr. Ryan.
And then I have two more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative. Yes, I can. Those original discussions, as I recall them from Legacy Funding Committee and from previous discussions that we had, was number one, we know and recognize that that's actually a legislative wish that we stay in collaboration with the DNR and also with Met Council. We caucus frequently with our partners in that regard, and the question always comes down to when we begin discussing those things, who's responsible for what, et cetera, et cetera. I would tell you that my strongest answer with that would be is that we're always in frequent contact with DNR staff, planners, administration, to make sure that we don't supplant or somehow get into somebody else's bailiwick. We spend a lot of time with them so that that doesn't happen.
Okay.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ryan, out of those 90 proposals, how many of them, or give me an approximate number, were for education of people about the outdoors or outdoor park and trail experiences for children and adults?
Mr. Ryan.
Thank you. Frankly, madam, not enough. That's one of the four pillars. And the commission has discussed that at length. And we just began last month discussing some type of initiative to make sure that connecting people to the outdoors is something else that we're going to begin working on. if I may, the other reason for that is that from the legacy, the five-year legacy review, if you will, one of the things that we heard as we sat in sessions was the notion that you don't have to spend grand money on every project. And that really sang to us as a former vice chair of Legacy Advisory Committee. I sense that as well. So you will see some work from us regarding connecting people to the outdoors. Right now, it seems like it may be perhaps in the context of train the trainer and making, as an interpretive naturalist, I believe in that very strongly. So I'm glad you pointed that out, because it's something that, due to the workload, we hadn't concentrated on as hard as we should have, in my view.
And, Mr. Chair, one last question then. Out of the 90,
yeah,
how many were for new parks or new trails?
Mr. Ryan.
Approximately.
I can't provide you with that information right now. We have it. We'd be happy to.
We would like to know that.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I will say is that the workload of the commission itself, and with the E-teams being the practitioners and the experts and some of our consultants, the commission on your behalf haven't gotten into the weeds about specific proposals yet. We're still trying to run the business for you, but we can get that to you for sure.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, whatever, Manager, whatever your name
is. Mr. Ryan.
One of the issues that we were most concerned of when we set up this commission and so forth is that there didn't seem to be good definitions and good classifications of regional parks in the area. And I think we were basing it on, in the metropolitan area, particularly in the city of Minneapolis, I really understand what a regional park is and what the criteria is and what a neighborhood park is, even if sometimes the same people go to them. And I don't think I understand that for Greater Minnesota, and I don't understand how the definitions are made. And it seems to me there was something that I saw that have an awful lot of things that are called regional parks for what the population of the area is. So I want to know how we distinguish between how you are going to be distinguishing between regional parks and, you know, local parks.
Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn. We're still working on that as well. One of the challenges that we have is, under the old DNR system, there were three or four criteria that seemed to fit. A park that was 100 acres or greater, proof that it served more than the local population, and or if it had specific natural or historic features, an old mill or a stagecoach bridge, things like that. And one of the things about the new plan is that we recognize that we have to make sure that we're in concert with our other partners. And so just in the last month, we've gone back to our respective districts and are seeking the opinions of the district planning committee members as well. It's not hard for me to admit, nor any of my colleagues, that what a regional park is, to some degree, is a moving target. Acreage comes into play, the amount of people they serve, etc. But we haven't quite nailed that just yet.
Okay. Well,
Representative Kahn.
I would think that's really important to do as quickly as possible.
Yes, ma'am.
And it's not total numbers of people served. It's also, to become regional, it has to be numbers of people from outside the immediate vicinity.
That's
as
true.
Opposed to this. And it doesn't mean that it's not a worthwhile park. It's just that we're trying to fit into, and I don't see anything wrong with those DNR criteria, but I think that's a high priority of something that needs to be done.
We agree.
And you need to end up, I think, with a somewhat more limiting definition of what a regional park is.
Thank you. We agree. I will. Oh, excuse me.
Okay.
I was going to say, Representative Lilly has a question. Let's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At first, kind of a general comment. You know, as we still come off this campaign season, it always fascinates me, because we had the great rural divide with the metro folks. But when I look at your particular area with this trails, the rural folks sure love to see our minivans and cars with the bike racks on the back and those sort of things going out to these parks and trails from Representative Wills and Phyllis, Representative Kahn's in my district. And so it's always an interesting deal where you hear, I know a representative from southern Minnesota complains about the spandex or something. I just want to be clear. I've only seen Phyllis Kahn in spandex. I prefer not to wear it. I just think middle-aged men should not wear spandex.
Kim, I need to say something right. My name was mentioned, and I need to say something right there.
I'll get to you in a second, but I recall a representative on a bonding trip that took his shirt off.
Well, that's entirely okay.
To point out, when we're looking at Representative Lilly for an expert on what to do when bicycling, he rode across the country in one, the wrong direction, and without clipped pedals on his bicycle. So he made it three times as hard as it had to be. So, I mean, that's because he didn't consult me before he started out, which would have included wearing spandex shorts.
Mr. Chair, although I like the credit, I Representative Kahn has a few more degrees than I do. I just went to a simple college in Decorah, Iowa, but I didn't get all this Ivy League stuff. But I don't know if she knows anything about the wind on the earth versus the wind in the jet stream.
I think you guys should bring pictures.
So, Mr. Chair, just to continue my actually had question for the folks.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I also serve on a capital investment committee and then through Legacy, and we've been able to tour the state, and there's some great outstate energy and efforts that are going on. I particularly like what we met with the folks in Detroit Lakes, mm-hmm. and we had some people from local businesses that were interested, and then Duluth certainly has a great mountain biking, and I'm jealous of Mr. Heitzman's area, of course, what's going up in the Cayuga area, but I'm just curious what you're doing. Are you making any efforts to work with the business communities to tie in some of the legacy projects, to get folks out there, not only business, and, to have it be a job creator, to encourage that, but also tourism. So that would be my first question. And then kind of a challenge. It's my theme for the session a little bit. It's more of a comment, but I hope you're considering mobility issues in your projects and as our population ages and so diversity, not just in diversity, but with mobility issues, so that you take a look at making sure that we have as much access to everybody as, that can get out and use our systems. So that's it.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, your points are well taken, and you're absolutely right. One of the things that is as important to us as it is with our friends with the DNR and also Met Council is tourism. And some of our districts, of course, depend on that seasonally with different types of recreational opportunities. It's good for us all to be aware that the recreational needs and the business needs of District 1, perhaps, in the Northeast are different than in Southeast in some way, and that those districts have a voice. We've also been able to be successful with the Legacy Advisory Committee, making sure that the business communities are represented with that. Now, that's a DNR-generated committee, but we have representation there as well because we're one of the three. So that is very important, and I'm also glad that the representative mentioned the idea about trying to serve as many populations as possible. To that end, one of the things that we will be assisting, or actually will probably be the lead, and the DNR will help us with this, is for ORV-type recreational opportunities, and also certainly with mountain bikes. One of the things that we've been talking about is that there are some great proposals in that 90. However, they seem to be, at least at first blush, kind of cloistered. And we want to make sure that we don't overbuild in one district, or the E-team suggests to us that we don't overbuild in one district and leave others out. So in the 3 to 5 years that we anticipate building this system, those questions have come up and are important. And if I may, Mr. Chair, one of the things that Elizabeth helped me with is regarding Representative Kahn's questions about designations of regional parks. I should have been more thorough in my answer regarding that we do have designated types of parks, special natural resources parks, special attraction, etc., and they are in the plan. I was alluding to the challenge of making sure that we keep everybody engaged with this, because many folks, for instance, my agency, Olmsted County in particular, we have regional parks, we think. However, we're not exempt from applying as well. And so we are going to see, we're going to be spending a lot of time trying to, I don't know, grind that term and find out what it really means. And I hope that, I hope with Elizabeth's help, I answered that a little better.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Ryan, you got 5 minutes left.
All right, thank you. You'll forgive me, I kind of lost my spot. I'm on. Where were we? Were we on page 7? Yeah, right here.
I think that's where you are, right there.
Excuse me. All right. I'm going to go to page 8 and continue in our report to you. As you see, this is no surprise to you. This is where I personally met some of you several years ago. 20% of Parks and Trails funds for Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails. That was the original deal. We're sticking to it. We got a lot of work to do, and we need to stay loyal to our customers as well and our internal partners. So there's been, the commission has literally had no discussions about seeking more of that at this time. That's not our charge, frankly. That's for you all to decide. Approximately $8.5 million we anticipate in fiscal year 2016, and $8.9 million in 2017. But as you know very well, we can all hope for is that may increase with good news here. The DNR commissioner is going to continue to make the grants based on recommendations, and that's a strong word, it's recommendations of the commission. And then, of course, in time, as we grow and become vetted and get these things worked out on our state's behalf, the future biennium, the recommendations will come directly to you all. That's the plan. That's written in the plan, and we've had to modify a few things with your permission just due to the workload that we're going through. So, page 9, to carry out the legislative charge, Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission needs funding, and we have some requests that we think working on your behalf are important. We request $356,000 for 2016 and $362,000 in 2017. This amount is based on budget and less than 4.25% of total appropriation in Greater Minnesota, and the DNR seeks up to 2.5% of that for actual cost of issuing and monitoring the grants. Here's where it matters, folks, we think. The budget items include, that ask includes certainly the perfunctory things, commission meeting costs, the E-team costs, those experts that aren't connected to anything other than doing good things for Minnesotans. The district planning committee costs, those are the folks that we go back to in our respective districts and say, hey, what's important for this district? Some website hosting with GoMin, and that's been a moving target. We've been working very hard with consultants, as others have, to get a better way to get our word out about these legacy funds. The commission staff, and if I may, I just want to add a couple things about that one, because it's my personal opinion and professional opinion that's very critical, and I'm not alone on the commission with that. As I mentioned, we spent well over 2,000 hours of commission business already with essentially a volunteer group. We have two retirees, several members who are public employees elsewhere. Illustratively, my leadership in Olmsted County thinks this is important and sent me. We have a strong need for professional commission staff for continuity in the mission, to provide context and history and a singular voice related to customer service, because people are going to come and go on this commission. And last but certainly not least, accountability to the legislature and to our customers, which we share those, and our peer professionals. So we feel very strongly about the need for staff. In the bill and in some of the things that you have, it's stated that it would be an executive director support staff. and then also some kind of web-based assistance. I would argue that we have more at risk now than we did when we started, because we have a great body of work for you in the last 14 months, and now we're concerned that we make sure that this product that's been produced is guarded and protected with the importance of staff. And then, last but not least, excuse my voice, information about the commission and all of us, etc., we're certainly at your disposal. legacy.leg.mn/Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission, and then you can see that we also respond to emails on that other site.
Well, thank you. Any other comments or questions? Representative Kahn.
Could we have some comparison about what we've done about funding of administrative expenses for this compared to, say, the metro area?
Yes, we could look into that.
Do we do any funding of the administrative expenses to working on metro regional parks?
Yeah, I'm assuming that comes out of the funding that they're given.
I don't know. It's just a question.
Yeah. Could we check into that? Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank
you. Mr. Chair, if I may, would there be any possibility tomorrow, St. Patrick's Day, as you know, is there any chance that, like, park commission meetings throughout the state of Minnesota wouldn't have to occur on St. Patrick's Day? Is that something you all do here, or is it? Am I out of line for asking that?
Well, I think perhaps, Mr. Ryan, the location of the meeting could be changed for you.
Thank you, sir. I'll pass that on to my commission.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we, at this time, have the presentation by Indian Affairs Council. Welcome, Ms. Hill.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Thank you for this opportunity. And it's only proper to wish you a happy St.
Erhol's Day.
Day, yes.
As a half Finlander.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I forgot to wear my purple in honor.
I'm none at all. My wife is 100%. But we've got about 15 minutes.
Yes, we do. So I will be quick. Representative Erdahl, members of the committee, my name is Anna Marie Hill, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and I'm a proud member of the Red Lake Nation. Thank you for this opportunity to present to your committee today. Before you, you have a letter addressed to Representative Erdahl and the members of the committee, and pertaining and detailing our request for funding from this committee. First, on the agenda, and I also have individuals here that will speak to you very specifically. Again, I will be very brief. Indian Affairs Council has been the recipient of Dakota and Ojibwe Language Revitalization Funds since 2010. So we have just recently finished our sixth year of funding to American Indian tribes and communities, individuals who are doing the work of language revitalization throughout this entire state. Indian Affairs Council has been the recipient of this funding, has dispersed this funding to the entire state on an RFP competitive grant process. There have also been individual schools that have received this funding from 2010 until the present. In addition to that, in the first two bienniums, we had a language revitalization working group that consisted of individuals statewide, and also there is a lot of information because there were organizations and individuals that were contributed to this feasibility study for the state legislature from Canada and from Hawaii and throughout the world. And the information is detailed here. It's on. It's at the Legislative Law Library for your reference and review. But with that, I also want to acknowledge that we have supportive people in this audience, many individuals who are important to the work of language revitalization that are sitting over there, and that have been doing the hard work of bringing back these two most important languages, the Dakota and Ojibwe language, in the state of Minnesota. And also, I do want to point to our individual asks here to the Legacy Funding Division Committee. And the first one that I have put down here is a total of $3 million for Dakota and Ojibwe language immersion to the following schools. And I have attached to our request also letter is a copy of the bill draft. The bill will be introduced this afternoon by Representative Hancock. In addition to that, we also respectfully request your consideration for funding for $200,000 total for our cultural resources program to develop an osteology laboratory and repository for American Indian human remains. And at the very end of this, I'll have Mr. Jim Jones, our cultural resources director, be available and answer any questions if in lieu of time. In addition to that, $250,000, $125,000 each year for our continuing development of education resources and events and tour of the Why Treaties Matter exhibit. I also have information for the Why Treaties Matter exhibit. The exhibit is currently not funded by the Legacy, but it began it with funding from the Legacy Committee in 2010 in partnership with the Minnesota Humanities Center, and I can safely say it has turned out to be one of the most, if not the most popular exhibits that has ever run in the state of Minnesota. Well over 100,000 viewers. We have two exhibit panels that are traveling now, funded by Minscu Institution, to every Minscu Institution statewide, but also funded by Blandin. And we have an additional exhibit that was donated to Indian Affairs through the Mayo Clinic, and we cannot keep up with the demand. This exhibit is meeting the needs of our students everywhere, of our communities everywhere, on the important absent curriculum and information that's out there for our citizens of Minnesota. So those are for your consideration, and I thank you for that opportunity. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Leslie Harper, Leech Lake member, who was instrumental in the very beginning of the development of this language revitalization program. And she is one of the people I go to for most everything language. And she would like to address the committee at this time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
I am Leslie Harper, and I was raised in the Cass Lake community on the Leech Lake Reservation, and I just thank you all for coming in here today and for having us in here to talk about our languages and our legacy funding requests. I was advised that we have a very brief time period today. if you gave me a chance, I could go on for days about Ojibwe and Dakota languages and in our state. I will not, however, I will stick to the statement that we provided here. I just want to give you some word on the benefits and the positive aspects of our Ojibwe and Dakota languages and the connection to pride and to confidence and to integrating successfully our citizenship ideals in many of our communities across the state of Minnesota. We have in-service field experience from the last decade in many of our communities, and we can talk about the ways that funding and public policy are supporting the transmission of our cultural heritages through the media of Ojibwe and Dakota languages. And we do request funding appropriations to help continue meeting those needs. Currently, we recognize the need to continue funding for the Native Language Preservation Programs administered through the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council in the amount of $3 million for the next biennium. I was previously the director of our Native Language Immersion School at Leech Lake, and currently I am co-chair of a national coalition of Native American Languages schools. We partner with Native American Language Immersion schools across the U.S., schools who have been affected by the ESEA and the policies within, and we are bonded by a commitment to providing language education through the medium of our indigenous languages. We in northern Minnesota at the Leech Lake Reservation have operated an Ojibwe language immersion school, and we have students. Since we started, we graduated four cohorts of students who experienced a 90-10 model of Ojibwe language immersion from kindergarten through sixth grade.
Ms. Harper, how many students would that be?
Approximately a dozen.
So, first, how many native speakers are there now?
The last estimate, which has not yet been confirmed, was that we ran under 500 in the state of Minnesota. That's Ojibwe language speakers. Dakota language is much, much more critically endangered. There are less than a handful of first speakers of Dakota language in our state. When we talk about the cultural heritage and legacy of Minnesota, however, and we talk about our language preservation efforts, what we found is that our Ojibwe and our Dakota language revitalization efforts are outpacing the loss. In the last 5 years, we have begun to build new speakers. The youth that are sitting here with me today are going to attest to some of the Ojibwe language projects, and I know that our new younger language learners in our Dakota communities as well are coming up and are becoming more highly proficient and more highly functional in the Dakota language. So we are building new speakers in our state.
Can you give me a short answer as to what is the difference between Ojibwe and what is the other language?
Dakota.
Oh, that I didn't understand. I get that one. Never mind.
Okay. Egret.
But how many a year are being taught?
I do not have the figure on the Dakota languages in the state. I apologize.
Ojibwe then.
Oh, in Ojibwe, we teach at several of our regional universities and most of our public schools in the northern area and surrounding the reservations teach Ojibwe language. In the public schools, it's open to all students. Ojibwe and Dakota language are recognized as world languages in the state of Minnesota. So they would fulfill a world languages credit requirement as well. So it's not only our Native American students who are benefiting from it, if there are non-Native students who wish to take Ojibwe language as a world languages course, it's available for them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Central to most of our efforts in language preservation is the, you know, and I've got it laid out in the testimony, cultural historical activity theory. It's an old Vygotskian idea that lays down that issues of culture and language, cognition, everything in our brain, everything that we play out in systems operations in our community are based on patterns of culture. I've laid it out in my testimony. I've written it up. I've written the articles. We've read the research articles. But what does that mean to our legacy, our legacy fund, our cultural heritage fund? It means that we should celebrate the idea that activity, cultural-based community activities, are the setting in which all of our brain, all of our social functions are best developed, and that cultural basis. We need to continue to recognize that our Ojibwe and our Dakota communities within the state of Minnesota have managed to maintain unique cultural identities while moving forward. We still maintain those identities and those perspectives in our state, and we're still contributing to it. We're transmitting citizenship ideals from our Ojibwe and our Dakota perspectives, and we would do well to continue to support Ojibwe and Dakota language projects here in Minnesota. The programs that have been funded have been language immersion schools. They have been competitive grant projects across the state in many different communities. They've been really critical in a lot of those community areas. I was also able to sit on the volunteer work group that produced the report earlier, and we heard from communities all around the state that were funded. And the programs tend to enhance the social, cultural, psychological, spiritual, intellectual well-being of our Native children and, by extent, our Native families. And we're helping to ensure that these languages grow in the state of Minnesota from these critically endangered numbers to, in the long run, cultural and more vital languages. We are increasing the number of speakers. We are increasing the number of positive benefits of Ojibwe and Dakota perspectives in the state.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your work on that. I'm sorry I can't pronounce Dakota. But you have other testifiers here?
Yes, we do. We have brought, there are two students from our Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Reservation who have been through our language immersion schools, and they would also like to present a brief testimony on the benefits of Ojibwe.
Welcome. Identify yourself, please, and continue.
Hello. My name is Mitakamazi Liberty, and I'd like to talk about Ojibwe and how it has affected and benefited.
I think you're going to have to say your name a little slower, or we're not going to get that. And louder, please.
Okay. My name is Mitakamazi Liberty. Mitakamazi is how you would say it. And I'd like to talk about Ojibwe and how it has affected and benefited my life. Ojibwemoin is not only a language, it is a way of life with its own teachings and morals. Not only has Ojibwemoin given me a language I can use to connect and speak with my elders and family, it has given me an identity that I can be proud of. This language has given me a way to associate with, connect with, and share a unique kind of pride with my family. I can share a deeper connection with my family knowing that we share a connection with this land and this world through the teachings of the Ojibwe language and the heritage it gives us. The identity Ojibwemoin has given me emboldens my efforts in life both in and out of school. The heritage I have in result of having this language causes me to have high academic goals. I am enrolled in advanced placement courses at the Trek North High School now, and I work hard to do well. I have these high goals because I want to make my family and my people proud. My friends who went through Ojibwemoin Immersion School and now attend Trek North High School are also enrolled in advanced courses and participate in leadership roles in the school. We will participate in college courses next year while we are in 11th grade through post-secondary education options, which require us to maintain our level of consistent achievement in our grades and keep up with the pace of college courses. These aims allow me to strive for academic knowledge more than I would otherwise. I'd like to believe that Ojibwemoin immersion has, and continued community support of our language has given me the confidence to go after these goals. I want other kids to have this pride and goals as well as others. And I want to be able to see them meet those goals. This is why I believe that Ojibwemoin has been a benefit to my life, and I'd like to extend that benefit to others.
Well, thank you. Mr. Liberty, so how long have you been in this program?
I have been in this program since my age of 4 years old in 2004 up till 2011. Because our program only went to from kindergarten to sixth grade.
Okay, well, thank you. Appreciate your efforts in learning this. Welcome.
Annie, can I wear? Get you in the window.
Louder, please.
Okay. Anina Kanawia and Gitjamin Randan, Omayayan, Ekwelash, Indigenous Kaz, Bagaduaning, and Dunjaba, Bemijigamaganda, and Ashinija, Bibunigis, and Gikikinwa, Amagu, and Manigani, Gabe, Ojibwemo, Gikinwa, Madiwigamigum, Nijwasa, Bibun. Hi everyone, I'm really happy to be here. My name is Nakaya Losh. I was born on the beautiful Leech Lake Reservation in Bauckland, Minnesota. I currently live in Bemidji, Minnesota. I'm 12 years old and this is my 7th year at Nigani Ojibwe Language Immersion School. I'm very glad I get to experience learning Ojibwe at Nigani. Nigani has taught me so much. I've learned how to speak in my traditional language, and I've learned a lot of our Anishinaabe teachings about how we treat each other, the earth, and ourselves. It's taught me how to be respectful and loyal to our way of life. I've enjoyed learning some of the traditional activities such as gathering and processing wild rice, making maple syrup. When I was school age, my grandpa Johnny Mitchell told my mom about the Nigani program and decided that was where I was to be enrolled in school. The language is very important to me and my family. It's something that has kept us close. I've learned so much from my elders and teachers. I would not be where I am today if it wasn't for their support and encouragement. I'm glad there are opportunities for funding to help keep our indigenous languages alive. Ojibwe is not just a language, it's a way of life worth protecting.
Thank you. Are there any comments or questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hill or Ms. Harper, when you first came before us, if I remember right, we were talking about a very small number of elders that were first language speakers and were telling the history and the stories. And somehow the number 8 registers in my mind. Today, did we find any more elders than as we started with the programs of teaching the language and finding? And then you talked today about the first language people, and now the teachers. Mr. Liberty said that his program stopped in the sixth grade, and then so they didn't follow him into, but now maybe when he takes PSEO he's going to pick up again. I just would, if you could give me a little history of what happened between your first appearance before this committee and today, and the numbers of teachers, the numbers of families that are using the language and communicating, as well as the numbers of students that are enrolled in classes that Representative Erdahl asked about earlier.
Ms. Hill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, yes, that number 8 would be 8 or 9 was the original number of the remaining Dakota first speakers. It would have been a number about 8 or 9, and I do remember in the first 4 years or 5 years of administering this program and developing all the developing the language report and feasibility study plus dispersing the funds that we lost quite a few of those original first speakers. Those original first speakers would have been approximately, I would say, you know, now from 70 to 90 years old, or say 100 years old approximately. My father is an Ojibwe first speaker, and my father is 78 years old. So, and my father is also gravely ill, and so each day we hope to have him. But he is a prime example to me of the language. As he passes on, he takes that first language with him. And Leslie, I'll defer to Leslie Harper to give you some idea of perhaps how many of our Ojibwe first language speakers that we've lost to date, and perhaps how many remain, because I'm not exactly certain about many of the Ojibwe first speakers that we have remaining to today.
Ms. Harper?
So there's a question on any more elder first speaking resources found, numbers of teachers, numbers of families using languages, number of people served by classes now. I think that's what we've got, Ms. Murphy. Certainly our Dakota language communities are losing their first speakers, and that's what I was referring to in my testimony as well, in that we are starting to build up new speakers of our languages. It's a massive effort to put in the hours and the time and to be able to support people through gaining a high level of proficiency and being able to operate that at that level. But we are in a really transitional and transformative period when we're talking about our languages in our state, when we're talking about Dakota and Ojibwe languages. We are going to start having to look at what are we doing to build new speakers. We are going to be looking at having second language and third language acquisition people coming in, people who are learning it as a second or a third or a fourth language. These are now going to be our resources, and this is the reality that our Ojibwe and Dakota communities are facing. We are going to have to rely on our new learners of our language. So we need to strengthen our efforts right now, whether we're talking about programs in the community that support families in using the language in the homes, whether we're talking about elementary school-based sites that are teaching and using the language as a medium of instruction, or whether we're talking about rigorous college and university courses. The Indian Affairs Council competitive grant program has been able to support several different projects and wide-reaching iterations of how do we build these new language speakers. Like I said, we have now dipped under 500 first speakers of Ojibwe language in the state, and that spread across our entire population of Ojibwes in the state. While we certainly could look to import people are very, very connected to their homelands, and we can urge people to come in and to move in with us and to support us from other areas. But also we'd like to look at building our capacity here and saying, what can we do here with our own local folks, with our own regional folks, and rebuild that right here.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And well, hopefully we will be able to assist you.
Thank you.
Great.
Next. We have a funding report for No More Gallant Deed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Good Identify afternoon. Yourselves and begin, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Holman.
I'm the producer of the film No More Gallant the Deed, and this distinguished gentleman to my right is the co-producer and director of the film, Bill Siemens. And I'd like to thank Commissioner Erdahl and the members of the committee for hearing our testimony this afternoon. After a few opening remarks on my part, Bill will speak to the film, the story behind it, and why we find it so interesting and important. And then I'll have a few closing thoughts before answering your questions, I hope. Our company, First Minnesota Films, LLC, is seeking $750,000 from the Legacy Fund allocation for this biennium to complete production of our film. We are operating under the fiscal sponsorship of IFP Minnesota, Center for the Media Arts. Today, through the generosity of private donors, we have spent in excess of $100,000 doing the deep research and storyboarding required in the development phase of a project like this. Researchers around the country were working with our local team to find images and documents in support of our story. This resulted in identifying and locating over 2,500 photographs as well as other types of memorabilia for use in supporting the visual aspect of the film. It also resulted in the storyboarding and scripting of a four-hour version of the film from which will emerge the two-hour final version. In January 2010, a document was released titled Minnesota State of Innovation, a 25-year vision framework, guiding principles, and 10-year goals for the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. In the document is a list of six activities which are recommended be given the highest priority for ACHF investment. They are the creation, performance, and exhibition of artistic works, the preservation and presentation of Minnesota's history and cultural heritage from its earliest peoples to the present day, the dissemination of programming and information about Minnesota's arts, history, and cultural heritage to technology and media, the public interpretation of our history and cultural heritage, arts, history, and cultural heritage learning opportunities for all ages, and collaborations among arts, history, and cultural heritage organizations. First Minnesota Films believes that the film No More Gallant a Deed, dealing with the wonderful history of the 1st Minnesota Volunteer Regiment in the Civil War, and related productions will, when complete, meet all of these priorities. Why? Because upon completion of the project, Minnesota Films LLC will have produced a documentary film of the 1st Minnesota set against the backdrop of Pioneer Minnesota, at that time the youngest state in the nation, one telegraph line, and no railroads at all at the beginning of the Civil War. Broadcast the film on TPT, and they are eager to present it to the state of Minnesota and inclined to take it to the national PBS network as well. Assisted communities in staging local photo and art exhibits exploring pioneer life and our state's role in the Civil War. Distributed copies of the film with age-appropriate study guides to Minnesota schools. Produced, published, and distributed several books and DVDs about the 1st Minnesota Regiment. And then mentored and sponsored young filmmakers to make supporting documentaries about life in their home communities during the Civil War. I'll talk a little bit more about some of these later, but first, a bit about the film from my partner, Bill.
Thank you. Identify yourself again, please.
I'm Bill Siemens, Chairman Erdahl, and members of the committee. In 1928, President Calvin Coolidge came to Cannon Falls, Minnesota, and 20,000 people came to hear him speak in the reinterment of Colonel William Colville in his final resting place. President Coolidge said on that day, "In all the history of warfare, this charge, the charge the 1st Minnesota made at Gettysburg, has few, if any, equals and no superiors. It was an exhibition of the most exalted heroism against an apparently insuperable antagonist. By holding the Confederate forces in check until other reserves came up, it probably saved the Union Army from defeat. So far as human judgment can determine, Colonel Colville and those eight companies of the 1st Minnesota are entitled to rank as the savior of their country." We have made a number of documentaries, World War II documentaries, six of them. We've won 13 national awards, and all of that pales before the story of the 1st Minnesota. I believe Chairman Erdahl is well versed in this, but for those of you who aren't, our governor was in Washington on the day President Lincoln wanted 75,000 troops for 3 months. because it would be a brief war, probably just one battle. Our governor went to see the Secretary of War and said, Minnesota pledges 1,000 men. Simon Cameron said, write it down, we'll take it to the president. We were the very first regiment to sign up to serve in the Union Army. Now, Minnesota was bunched all on the eastern part of the state because there were Indians out there. The Great Sioux Rebellion was to happen in 1862. Ten companies of 100 men each would be formed and then come to Fort Snelling for training, and the 1,000 members of the 1st Minnesota would be off to war. There are so many thrilling events in the life of this regiment. As we went east, the 1st Minnesota held their initial parade down the streets of Chicago, where they were claimed by the Chicago Tribune to be the finest looking bunch of men they'd ever seen. The personalities involved in this film, I'll just mention a few. Charlie Goddard, Company K, Winona, was 15 years old, and he pleaded with his mother to let him enlist. Yes, you can, if you will write me every day. Charlie, when he got to Fort Snelling and they were going to go through their physicals, realized he would be asked how old he was. He had taken a piece of paper and written the number 18 on it and put it in his shoe. And when the medical examiner came, which was simply turn around and let me look at you from both sides, they said, how old are you, son? And Charlie said, I'm over 18. And he was on that day. Patrick Henry Taylor and his brother Isaac, school teachers, enlisted. Isaac fell victim to a Confederate shell that shaved off half of his body. His brother went out in the field in the dark and buried his brother. Edward Bassett, Company G, Faribault, wrote letters. We have hundreds of letters. There will be no talking heads in this documentary. There will be no reenactments. The real letters will be read by the direct descendants of the men of the first. Josiah King is on the statue, the top of the cenotaph here, as the first man to enlist in the 1st Minnesota. He made it through the war and became an officer. Aaron Greenwald, however, was most likely the very first, and however, he got a Confederate bullet right here in the charge. Stephen Miller, our fourth governor, walked up and down in a hail of Confederate bullets at Bull Run, saying, Minnesota hold, Minnesota stay, and they did. The letters coming back and the letters from Minnesota mothers to the governor are just heartrending. Sam Bloomer from Glarus, Switzerland, 18 European countries contributed men and boys to the first. Sam had part of his leg shot off at Antietam, and his letters are heartrending. Will a woman ever love me again? I'm damaged. Mother's writing, this woman, Mrs. Freeman, writing to Governor Ramsey, I think my son is a captive of the Confederates, and our neighbors were to come and help with the harvest, but they didn't come. And now I don't have victuals for the children, and it's getting cold. We will not leave the state behind as the first goes into battle. At Bull Run, they were heroes immediately and became known immediately through the army. The Pennsylvanians ran on their left, the New Yorkers ran on their right, and the 1st Minnesota, in military order, left the field. Again and again and again, at Antietam, where a member of the first from the Twin Cities said, you could walk to Osseo on the bodies and never touch the ground. At Gettysburg, a foolish Union general took his troops up to a higher ground, opening a 500-yard-wide gap right on the left flank. In the long, strung-out line, the 1st Minnesota was, and the Confederates saw this, and they sent 1,600 Alabamians toward that gap. If they'd flanked the Union Army, the Battle of Gettysburg would not have ended up as it did, nor would the war end up as it did, nor would the Union. The General Winfield Scott Hancock rode up to Colonel Colville and said, "What unit is this?" "First Minnesota." He knew of the first, and as he wrote, and you've received this in your package, he hated to send the Minnesotans on this charge, which was 350 yards down a slight incline. But he said, "We had no choice. I had to do it," and later on said, "There was no more gallant deed." They pinned their names on pieces of cloth or paper to their shirts, so that when their bodies were found and they all expected to die, they charged. And they broke the Alabamians' line, they broke their interior line, and they went on offense. But in fighting their way back out, they sustained the largest regimental losses in American military history. 82% of them went down. Out of 262, 42 remained standing and dazed on Cemetery Ridge, not realizing what they'd accomplished. They basically saved the Union that day. Everything about this regiment, the individuals, Colonel Colville, 6 feet 5 inches, 250 pounds, is special. After Gettysburg, they were sent to New York City because there'd been draft riots. The 1st Minnesota took care of that and then spent 10 days in Brooklyn. And New York City discovered the heroes of Gettysburg were in their midst. And it's just a miraculous period of time. One of the Taylor boys wrote home, "I actually ate dinner at a dining room table after sleeping on the ground for 3 years." Even coming home, February 1864 was incredibly dramatic. Freezing cold, stopped by snow in La Crosse, no railroad tracks in Minnesota, they took over the train and came back to St. Paul on the frozen Mississippi River, horse-drawn sleighs by torchlight. The story of this regiment is unlike anything I've ever read. This will be a very personal film, and we expect it to have a major effect on awakening this state. First of all, the 1st Minnesota was internationally recognized in 1864, and I am so excited to be able to put this together for our state and for our nation. It's a real professional capstone on a life of making films.
Thank you for that description. A little known fact that I am the last casualty of the Battle of Gettysburg of the 1st Minnesota.
Really?
Yes. When we went there for the sesquicentennial, I dressed in my Civil War uniform, marched out with the 1st Minnesota reenactors, met the Alabaman reenactors on Plum Run Creek, and then marched back, and soon discovered that I had contracted the worst case of poison ivy in my life. So I am the last casualty of the 1st Minnesota.
I should add, Miss.
I was a casualty. You didn't have that poison ivy.
I should add, Mr. Chairman, that my great grandfather was a member of the 1st Minnesota Company F Red Wing. And so there's another reason my heart is in this.
Yeah. I haven't come across any poison ivy references in any of the literature I've read, though. So it's maybe a recent manifestation.
Now, it certainly was there. Representative Murphy.
Yep. There were other people on that trip watching
yes.
you get poison ivy.
I have just a few closing
just comments. Finish up, please. I want to try to get to Representative Green yet here today.
Yep. In the packet, I have a list of top 10 reasons to fund No More Gallant a Deed. You can either read them or I'll read them really quickly here. Among the many great Minnesota stories, and there are many great Minnesota stories, The story of the 1st Minnesota Volunteer Regiment may well be the greatest. It certainly stands right at the top. This is a film produced by Minnesotans for Minnesotans. Every member of our team is homegrown. The production funds will be spent right here in Minnesota, creating jobs and supporting jobs. All the support companies we will use in creating the film are here, from editing, sound, music, marketing, broadcasting. TPT will be given the broadcast rights to the premier broadcast rights to the film. DVD and streaming copies of the film will be provided to all Minnesota schools, along with age-appropriate study guides that will be developed with cooperatively between the Minnesota Historical Society and the Humanities Council. City and county historical societies for the 10 communities who sent companies of soldiers to the 1st Minnesota will receive help programming exhibits and events. And every society we've worked with is excited by that prospect. And exciting to us is we would like to develop a young filmmaker program in those 10 communities to help reach out and celebrate their community's involvement by getting young filmmakers to produce 10 to 15 minute short subjects on their community's history. Because the root of the Minnesota National Guard is the 1st Minnesota, we're already working with them to develop special initiatives. And we're shovel ready. All the research has been done. The photographs have been found. We're ready to get to go to work. So
thank you, Mr. Holman. And we have a short question from Representative Kahn.
Which is the question? Have you applied for funding from either the Regional Arts Council or the State Arts Board Council for this?
Not directly.
Or for this?
We haven't.
Or the snow bait? I don't know if would fall into that category.
No, the snow bait and they're all post-production initiatives, and we're looking for more of a pre-production initiative.
Representative Murphy Aaron.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I'm curious about, you mentioned your shovel ready, so curious about the time frame for this. If we were to fund this, what would it take in terms of time between now and production?
I believe that I can have a finished film within 1 year. We have such a huge mass of material that have been our researchers put together. I'll just quick example. Colonel Colville ended his life in Cook County. There's only 3 pictures of William Colville, but in the Cook County we found 3 more, and we've amassed things that have never been seen before about the 1st Minnesota. But my direct answer is 9 to 12 months.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like your top 10 list, and I appreciate that. And it looks as if from this list and your testimony that TPT is your initial target for broadcast. I am wondering if you've explored and have a better sense of the anticipated audience for the DVDs or streaming copies, and have you done any sort of assessment in terms of the schools and their interest in receiving this content?
The conversations that I had earlier on in the
Mr.
project
Holman.
Indicated that there was a great deal of interest, a lot of support from the Historical Society in getting involved in helping us develop the curriculums. So we believe we have the full array of the cross-arts community populace to get behind our project.
We've been absolutely
forward.
Astonished. We hear time and time, we did this, we were in the Civil War, people are just, there's many, many books that have been.
Yes, I know of them.
Pardon?
I know of a new one.
And you wrote half of them. So.
Yes. No More Gallant a Deed by James Wright, who was the color sergeant for the regiment, is truly the most extraordinary book written by one soldier in the Civil War. But it's 100% interest and then absolute astonishment. The people have forgotten what they did and what it meant. Enough so that President Lincoln twice came in his carriage to commend the 1st Minnesota.
Yeah. TPT is very interested in broadcasting the film.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair?
Thank
Mr. Chair, could I just ask one more question?
One more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
TPT participating or contributing at all to this project other than their interest in broadcasting?
Mr. Siemens.
There's a good chance that we will work within TPT production facilities. I have not, I've always worked independently on all the films that we made and put together my own crew and team, but we are talking seriously about bringing it into work with them.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I know I can tell how much this is in your ball of twine for sure.
Yeah, so thank you.
When we
thank
think
you.
Of things. But I do think, this is an important part of our history, part of Minnesota's history. And it's an important story to tell for generations to come. And so I just wanted to make sure I understood, the details of the production and your timeline, and hope and encourage partnership from places like TPT and others so that you are able to get this off the ground and into the schools so kids can learn about it.
Within our group
Mr.
of donors, it includes... It's a very broad range from Tom Heffelfinger has gotten behind us. Tom, his great-great-grandfather, with Chris Heffelfinger, was in the first. The Hubbard family has been behind us. Chris Spencer, one of our supporters, is up here today.
Walter Mondale
actually sparked the idea originally by recommending that we read a book. And we've heard from many institutions that we talked to, both corporate and private individuals, that... If the state comes in and supports, we will find doors opening all over the place for additional support, bringing on all these other opportunities that we've described in our write-up here.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now, last but not least, Representative Green has a bill to present to us. House file 462, and this will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. But first, I believe, Representative Green, you have an amendment that you'd like to move, the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move the A1 amendment to House File 462.
Thank you. Representative Green, would you briefly explain what that amendment does?
What the amendment does, it sets an effective date in visiting with the legislative auditor. He felt that January 1st, 2016 would be an appropriate date to get things set up. And if he would like to speak to that would be fine.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. First, for the record, I'm Jim Nobles, legislative auditor, and I want to
welcome Mr. Nobles.
I want to thank Representative Green for his bill and for the amendment. I think it is very much aligned with the mission of the legislative auditor's office. And certainly I think it is part of that very essential ingredient that we all seek in having good government, and that's accountability.
And Mr. Nobles, I'd just like to take the vote quick on the amendment, and then you can
all right,
talk
and the
about
amendment,
the...
I did, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right,
the amendment would simply give us an opportunity to get all of this set up in a way that makes it workable.
All right, thank you. Those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Now to the bill, please.
Well... Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is very simple, and it just allows for accountability. We set this up. We put laws in place to protect the taxpayers and their dollars, and there apparently have been some violations, and what this bill does is it will allow for the correction of those violations before we move forward with any more funding.
Mr. Nobles?
Mr. Chairman, as I was saying, and just will briefly repeat, I think, accountability is really the most important ingredient in seeking good government, and that's what this bill supports. We get that accountability in a lot of different ways, but certainly one is through oversight by the legislature and by the Office of Legislative Auditor, and all this does is just it tells recipients of money from the legacy funds that when we find a non-compliance, that they need to correct that before they come back and are eligible for funding again. And so that determination would have to be made, I think, in concert with work we would do in follow-up and present to you and this committee.
Okay, thank you. I don't know if you recall, Mr. Nobles, but when I chaired before, I would say to these groups that came before us that if you do not comply with the requirements that we have, that you should not expect funding in the future. So this actually would be in line with what we had verbally told them several years ago. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Green and Mr. Nobles, for bringing this forward. I think it's good stuff. What I'm curious about, though, is should you find that somebody is not eligible for further funding and they dispute your finding, would you be subject to litigation?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thorkelson, I will not be the final arbiter or determiner of whether or not they have complied or not. We would bring forth our information and present it to this committee. If they disputed that, that determination could be made by you. You will judge our position, their position. But I think, frankly, given the nature of the kinds of issues that we find in compliance, it could happen, but I think we'll probably be able to work out a common understanding of what compliance means.
Otherwise, Representative Torkelson, he said you would decide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fully informed and ready to vote.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Green. I got to give you a lot of credit. Ever since you've been on this committee, you've gathered Mr. Noble's reports and went through them thoroughly, and you've been consistent on that. And many use of my local business, I like to see people using Post-it notes, and it looked like you had a lot of Post-it marks on it. And so thank you for that. But no, you've been consistent, and I mean that sincerely in looking at the report, and we've been blessed by having Mr. Nobles look at these funds, and as it's rolled out in these first 5 years, it's certainly important to make sure we are taking a look and seeing where the money's going and what they're doing with it and have folks accountable. My only question is, and I'm not fully understand it, but it seems like we might be binding future legislators, and so that would be my only concern. Or I mean, I'm not, it's not a big thing, I mean, but would turn it into something illegal, I would think, or be a problem. But I'm sure you've thought that through, and maybe I'm just understanding it a little bit, but maybe you can explain just briefly. But hats off again to you for going into these reports so thoroughly, really, since day one.
Representative Green or Mr. Nobles, care to answer that?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer that question. I don't believe it would be binding future legislature because, again, we will bring forth the information that we have as to whether or not we think compliance has been achieved. But ultimately, under my reading of this law, you as the legislature would make that final determination. And frankly, I think we do all need to take this very seriously, and I'm sure we will. But as you well know, Representative Lilly, there is such a thing as notwithstanding, which always is a way in which the legislature is never bound by previous legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question either for the author or the auditor, as I'm, and again, new to this committee. And one of the messages that I continue to hear as we are doing our work is there seems to be continued confusion or a pursuit of clear understanding about the funding decisions that come from here based on the language passed in the constitutional amendment. And so I am curious to know what will guide the decision-making and the recommendations from the auditor's office when you take a look at the decisions that are being made. And if you think you can bring more clarity to those discussions than we've been able to achieve thus far. Over the weekend, I was teaching class at St. Kate's, talking with a group of doctoral nursing students, and we were talking about legislative intent. And even in my short tenure here, there is a disagreement often between what an author will intend in drafting and passing a piece of legislation and its implementation. And so I guess I'm curious to know how you will go about determining whether there's been some sort of violation versus a varying interpretation, and if you could give us some guidance on that.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Representative Murphy, it's a great question. It's what we confront all the time, whether it's legacy money or money from any fund where you make an appropriation and you give certain qualifications or, as we might say, strings attached to that money. And we follow the canons of statutory interpretation, and that those dictate that you first attempt to simply read the law on its face and take it literally for what it says. But if there is any ambiguity, we would certainly, again, following the canons of interpretation, we would look at all of the testimony surrounding that. It does bring me around, though, to the point I think you were certainly making, and that is the more you're able to be clear, the better it is for us and for everybody. The people that you appropriate money to, I think their intent is to comply. And so the more clear you can be, the better. And that's why, Mr. Chairman, and others on this committee, we have worked with you over the years, bringing back some of our findings to ask for greater clarity on things like what is an administrative expense and all of those various things. So I think we will just keep working on that.
And Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
And this would be a question then to the auditor. Do you have explicitly by our action in the legislature or implicitly in the authority that you already have the ability to do this in terms of other legislation that passes? And the reason why I ask is if this becomes law, do you think that other legislators or other efforts could come forward wanting to do the same thing, to ask the auditor to evaluate the work that we're doing to make sure that we're complying with our own intentions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, other people may look for this similar kinds of language for other funds. I think what's maybe a little bit different here, I think there are always, as I think all of you certainly know, some very special responsibilities about the legacy money because it was authorized by the people of the state. And there is a constitutional amendment attached to that, obviously. But what we will do is look at the appropriations laws, and you do typically submit into an appropriation some very specific language about how that money is to be used. That is not always true with some of the other appropriations, particularly for general fund, much more as the name implies, a general appropriation without very specific requirements attached. So to some degree, legacy money, like other dedicated money, out of the environmental fund or out of other dedicated funds, game and fish, often have very specific restrictions that are in the law that we look at.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
I appreciate you giving me a moment to ask a couple of questions. And my thinking or my comment is not really at all about the auditor and the work of that office, which I think is important. But I do think we should be cautious about this approach and what it means about our work and our authority as a legislature.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nobles made my notwithstanding comment for me, so I don't have to make that one. But I'm interested in, in some other, may have been state government finance. I talked about the ability of the legislative auditor to charge a legacy fund for the auditing of legacy accounts. Where are we going on that?
Mr. Nobles.
Chair and Representative Kahn, I think your bill and Representative Green's bill fit well together. Because what we intend to
a marriage of Kahn and Green. I like you. I like this.
It may have been unintended, but I think they fit perfectly together because you are going to give us some additional resources to help implement what Representative Green is doing in his bill. I might say, and it goes back with some of what Representative Murphy was saying, and that is with your bill, Representative Kahn. We are going to take that as a supplement to what we already are putting into auditing because we certainly, as the auditors, do not want to violate the constitutional principle and provision that legacy money is to supplement and not substitute for money that is already being used. So, again, I would just reiterate, I think it was maybe unintended, but this session, these two bills came together in a very nice way to allow us to do this.
Which, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn,
does that make both of us think twice about our bills? but the point I'm making, and I guess I want to make it for many things going on in this committee, is anything I think we do with legacy projects or with land acquired from legacy projects does not violate the supplement and not supplanting. Because once it has a legacy start, I think legacy is available for anything to finish it or implement it or anything else.
Okay. So, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about the bill language here. I don't know if it's better for Auditor Nobles or for Representative Green. On line 2.20 and 2.21, it says that the recipient is not eligible for future funding from the Parks and Trails Fund until the recipient demonstrates compliance. And the language for the Outdoor Heritage Fund and Clean Water Fund later in the bill is pretty much the same. I'm just wondering, it kind of follows along with Representative Murphy E. and Representative Lilly's questions. To whom is the recipient required to demonstrate compliance before it can be determined whether or not they're eligible for future funds? I'm wondering, is it to the legislature or is it to the legislative auditor?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding and my interpretation of it would be that it is initially a demonstration to the legislative auditor, but just like every other finding we have and every other report we have, it's advisory. We don't have any authority to bind anybody to anything. We cannot make you follow our recommendations, and you often don't. You do sometimes. So, again, you are preeminent in establishing the law, so I don't think there's any infringing upon your authority as the legislature to establish the law to appropriate money. The Constitution says you can control the purse strings. You decide what is appropriated. And so I don't think that infringes on that. I think it simply gives you a source of information. I might say one of the things, again, with the money that Representative Kahn has offered to us, what we hope to do is use this as kind of a pilot project. And we're just talking about it at the office, and that is that we would, on our website, that we would post our findings for legacy funds. And then we would allow the agency, the Pollution Control Agency, or a nonprofit organization, to post on our website what they are doing to resolve that issue. And then periodically, we would have someone go and meet with them and test that, and then make our determination as to whether or not that has been accomplished. I might say, Mr. Chairman, we issue a lot of findings about compliance, and the rate of agencies coming into compliance is very high. Usually these are more technical matters. Sometimes they're more serious and complicated, but oftentimes these are technical matters that simply need to be rectified.
Mr. Knowles, could you hold it, do you think?
I was just gonna follow up, Mr. Chair, if I may. It's not a question.
Real quick.
Sure. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I understand, through the incantation of the magic word, notwithstanding we have the ability not to bind ourselves to that. But it does seem a little bit, if it is, as you say, the legislative auditor that demonstrates determines who demonstrates compliance here, it does seem like there's a little blurring of the lines between legislative authority and auditing existing laws. So I think Representative Murphy's comments about exercising caution with this sort of approach, I guess I would agree with it.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Nobles, yes or no? Is this needed?
Mr. Chairman, I think it will help. It will send a message to people who receive money from you that you as a legislature take compliance seriously. So okay. I think it's a good message to send.
Thank you. Now, are there comments from the audience, from the gallery? Oh, I see Deputy Commissioner Meyer is here.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. We do have a couple of comments on the bill. First and foremost, transparency and accountability is number one within the department and the executive branch on the spending of any funds. Legacy funds are different. They cannot supplant. There's constitutional language surrounding that. We pay very close attention to it. I appreciate Representative Murphy's and Representative Freiberg's and the committee's discussion on the language in the bill, because it is very explicit that says If the OLA determines that a recipient of money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, for example, has not complied with the laws, rules, or regulations in this section or other laws applicable to the recipient, they're not eligible for future funding. The DNR does grant, with a pass-through granting authority for the Outdoor Heritage Fund, for the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Council appropriations as well. There's a lot of different appropriations. You're going to hear a lot of individual appropriations in that bill this evening. So the auditor is now going to have to look at each program, making sure they're in compliance, and we will not issue a grant unless, if somebody falls out of compliance, we will make sure that we have a certificate of compliance or a letter from the auditor confirming that they're in compliance before we issue those grants. So we're going to create a level of scrutiny that may or may not be needed. For some of the clean water funds, if there's grants going to local producers, for example, is the auditor going to audit all of these individual farmers who are receiving funds, making sure that they're in compliance? And then if somebody's out of compliance, correct that action and then send the Department of Ag or the PCA a certificate that they are in compliance? What if the department issues the grant and are we found out of compliance if one of our grantees is out of compliance? I mean, these are just some questions that we have. I don't think it's as simple as inserting the words notwithstanding any law to the contrary, X, Y, and Z organization is eligible for legacy funds. So I think there's some kind of common ground we can work on, but this may or may not be the answer. I'm not sure what the fiscal note would be, but you know, to create a staff that's going to audit about $300 million of appropriations annually, I don't know how many people that is, but I don't think the auditor has the staff to do that, and he raised a question that's going to take them a year to staff up for this appropriation, and then the question is what does that lead to out of the funds that the legacy funds are supposed to be spent on. So, Mr. Chairman, those are just a few of my questions. I know.
Thank you. I think Mr. Nobles would like to answer that. And we got about 3 minutes, and I got to wrap it up.
Mr. Chairman, that's not the way I read the law at all. What the law says is that if we find someone out of compliance, that doesn't mean we have to go and audit every appropriation all at once. It means that on our schedule, and our approach has been, we have gone, for example, to Arts and Cultural Heritage 1 year, looked at a sample of appropriations, gone over to Parks and Trails, looked at a sample of appropriations. There's nothing in this language that suggests that we are going to change that approach, that all of a sudden this language requires us to go out and do 300 audits. There's nothing in this language that says that. It says that if in whatever the schedule is that the legislative auditor establishes, the legislative auditor finds noncompliance, then that recipient is not eligible until that recipient demonstrates compliance.
All right, thank you. Ma'am?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gothier from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I would like to agree with what Commissioner Meyer said, but also just to raise a couple of other informational points as well. And one is that, I mean, we do many pass-through grants with Legacy Money, the Clean Water Partnership, septic system, stormwater BMPs, and all of our grantees, we sign a contract with them, and in that contract, they have to agree that they are in compliance with all laws, and also they have to comply with all the standards and policies of the Department of Administration's Office of Grants Management, which are on the website and everything, and they're out there. So we do already have that kind of information, and it's not clear to me from this language what the responsibility it would be for the agency acting as the fiscal agent. Does this mean we would no longer be needing to sign a contract with them that the grantee asserts that they are in compliance with all laws because now the OLA will take care of that? Or is there some kind of recompense that would come back onto the agency? So it's just not clear in the language.
Okay, well.
So we'd have some concerns about the clarity of it. It seems like it's blurring some lines here and it's confusing.
I think what I'm going to do at this point is ask that you two and others work with the author on your concerns. You know, I do recognize what Mr. Noble said, that, you know, these are cases that they have investigated or done an audit and discovered someone out of compliance, and those would be the people that would be then dealt with until they were in compliance. And it's not going to result in a mass investigation of every or audit of every project that is approved by this committee. So what I'm going to lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill and urge that you know, PCA and DNR work with Representative Green, and if there are some accommodations that could be made, then let's do so. With that, we are recessed until 15 minutes after session ends to room 10. Thank you. We are reconvening the Legacy Funding Committee, and we have the presentation of the LaSard Singh and Telcourt Heritage Bill by Representative McNamara, who is sitting directly in front of me wearing his invisible clothing. But we'll just start off here with the summary, and let's welcome and let's start it out. And Representative McNamara will be here shortly.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mark Johnson, the Executive Director for the LaSard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, and if it pleases the council, or if it pleases the committee, I have with me the new council vice chair, Jane Kingston. And I would like, with your permission, to have her do the overview for you.
Thank you very much. Proceed, please. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jane Kingston from the LaSard Sam's Council. What you have in front of you, I think in your packets, is the fiscal year 2016 Outdoor Heritage Fund summary. The tables and figures that follow summarize the expected impacts of the appropriations recommended by LaSard Sam's for fiscal year 2016.
You know what? I'm going to ask you just to halt right there. Take a long, deep breath, and we're going
to
let Representative McNamara move his amendment. Do you have two of them,
Mr. Chair? McNamara? Somebody would move my bill first. Has anybody moved the bill yet?
The bill will be laid over for possible inclusion, so I will move that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then
let's do
the amendments, and then we'll proceed.
Mr. Chair, if someone would first move the A14. The A14 is a technical amendment. If anybody needs
I will move the A14.
And Ms. Taylor can probably explain if anybody has any questions. Nobody has any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions on the A14? You want to briefly explain what it does, or Ms. Taylor?
Ms. Taylor will.
Mr. Chair, members, the A14 amendment basically fixes some numbers that didn't roll up correctly, and then there was a few language issues that the department brought to our attention, so they have been corrected as well. And it does remove the $15,000 legacy website appropriation because it is no longer needed, according to Mr. Hubinger.
All right. Any further discussion on the 814 amendment? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's carried. And then
Mr. Chair, I have another amendment. If you would move it, I can explain.
Yes,
it.
Yes, we have the
A17.
I will move the A17 amendment, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A17 was added in the House Environment Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee. It was a Hansen amendment that I accepted with the idea that it would stay non-controversial. It has not stayed non-controversial. There's a number of interest groups that have questions about it. And so in the spirit of the agreement with Representative Hansen, it would be removed if it stayed, if it became controversial. So, Mr. Chair, that's why the amendment's before us. It deals with pollinator lethal insecticide, and it affects lands in LSOHC acquisition. That's the amendment, Mr.
All right,
Chair.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Are there questions, comments on that amendment? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara. Is that a House position, or is that a LaSard Sam's position?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, it was added in the House. It was not in the original bill, so we would be consistent with the spirit of the bill in removing this. It was not. It did not come out of Lessard-Sams with this in the bill.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara.
Rep. Lilly?
Just curious, were you up, I understand you had a meeting last Friday of the Lessard-Sams, and were able to, sometimes you're able to discuss amendments. Is it something that they would consider friendly or not, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, I actually presented it to them that I would be presenting it to this committee to remove the amendment, so I didn't ask for their blessing in full disclosure. And I would say that Representative Hansen would rather I not remove it, but in the spirit of the way the amendment was added in Environment Committee, it was, if it stayed non-controversial, and some of the egg producers have concerns, and I would say they're legitimate concerns as we work on this. We have another bill dealing with pollinators and neonicotinoids that Representative Hansen and I are working on.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Chair McNamara, I'm sorry, thank you for the honest answers, and just tell us again what it was going to do or not do, and then I'm done.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Lilly, I never did explain what the original intent of Representative Hansen's legislation was. It says that any lands acquired by Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council can't be planted with pollinator lethal insecticide products. That arguably would mean that there is some corn seeds that these lands, and I think potentially other seeds also, that they could not be planted with, and that's a problem for the industry. Sometimes there's either food plots or temporary crops as they work through the cycle before they plant in a restored prairie. They might have a year of corn, then a year of soybeans, and then the restored prairie. And this would be problematic for some lands, and that's the gist. I would say that is the gist of the what the amendment's about.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I don't understand is that land that's bought, particularly for the purposes of the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Commission, is not land that we're looking at for cropping rights and things like that. And so clearly something that makes it
Representative Kahn, could you speak into the microphone, please?
Sorry.
Okay. Something that makes it much less useful, like these neonicotinoids, which people are talking about even trying to get banned on a federal level, seems to me to be a really bad idea. We're not talking about huge fields. We're not talking about the huge fields of crops. We're talking about the little pieces of land that are bought for different parts, you know, for the purposes of wildlife enhancement. And this seems to me to go exactly in the opposite direction to allow that.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn, I would say where it centers around is sometimes the land we buy, the year or two after we buy it, as it's transitioned into maybe permanent prairie, is planted with crops to control weeds and such as we prepare it to go to prairie. And so that's the transition time when this puts limits on what can be used to properly plant it. So your point that, yes, we do want to, generally speaking, want to get rid of this kind of a product on this kind of land because we want to encourage pollinators and we don't want to have pollinator lethal products or plants on the landscape.
Representative Kahn.
Well, let's go to what the Constitution says. The Constitution says that this money may be spent only to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. So this money is for habitat. So it seems against the Constitution to spend money on habitat that will kill its inhabitants by spraying pesticides on it. So
maybe I can, I better walk a little bit slower. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, what happens is, say you buy a quarter section that used to be the Kahn family farm, and now it's going to become a wildlife management area. and it was maybe planted in something last year, and now to prepare it to be planted in a prairie, we're going to plant it in row crops for a year or two to get good control of the weeds, because unfortunately, and this was con, like K-A-N-E, it's not the same spelling as yours, so it wouldn't be a relative of yours. My fictitious? Mr. Chair, help me out. This fictitious family I'm thinking of is not a relative of yours, but a different con. Uh-huh. So in that case, that's why this limitation would put a problem on limiting the seeds we could use on that land. That's what it's about, Representative Kahn, and that's where the problem is. I don't know if that's making more sense. And we'll probably get another discussion on the floor when Representative Hansen will be able to also answer it.
There's a chance that that happens. Representative Kahn? Yes,
are there any members of the public who are here to testify on this at this point?
I am not aware of any. Oh, there is one. Okay, welcome. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Kirk Peterson with Rice, Michaels, and Walther. I represent a group called the Pesticide Action Network. I had two people that were here earlier in the day that were prepared to testify this. I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I talked to you about this issue before, but didn't give you a chance on this one. Neither one of them could come back for this evening. They did submit a letter. They just sent a letter now to Gavin. And so rather than read that letter, I will say that Pesticide Action Network and other pollinator groups, specifically Pollinate Minnesota, Aaron Roop from that group, would like to see this language stay in. There is a lot of evidence, a lot of scientific evidence linking neonicotinoid use to pollinator declines. And rather than read the whole letter, the committee has it, and if that could be distributed later.
Is it?
You do. It just came through now. I apologize. It's late. Okay. Like I said, they were here before and didn't get a chance to testify, but I'll provide the committee with copies that need to be.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, we can. The walkthrough is going to take at least a half hour if you want. I understand where these folks are coming from, and I get their concerns, and we're working on those. I really think they're different than the concern I'm talking about. The language has problems in it. I get where we don't want to use neonicotinoid lethal plants when we're trying to encourage pollinators. But unfortunately, the language has got other implications, and I've already talked about those. But if you want, I can, or if you would, Mr. Chair, temporarily withdraw the amendment. We can do a walkthrough of the bill, and you can read their letter. I am familiar with what they're talking about, and I think my concerns will still be there, but I can leave it up to you. But if the letter's there, we certainly can make sure that people see it if they want to see it.
Mr. Chairman, I could read it now, or if staff could get it printed off, whatever's easier for you.
I think that I will temporarily withdraw the E-17 amendment. We'll get it printed off. We'll go back to the walkthrough. I think we're on page 25, and then no, we're not on page 25. I tried. And then we will bring it up later.
Does that mean I should start again? Jane Kingston, for the record.
Okay, you may continue.
Thank you. So this is the summary of the fiscal year 2016. There's 35 proposals for $100 million. They exclude expected impacts of the Conservation Partners Legacy Program. That's on pages 14 through 16, lines 14.5 through 16.6. So the what of the bill is the majority of activity is, or 77%, is enhancement and restoration. That includes and incurs no pilt liability. But the majority of funding, or 75%, is in acquisition. Of this amount, about 54% is in fee acquisition and 21% in easements. Pilt obligations are expected to be $174,000. 50 full-time employees will be funded with the appropriations. The WHO is, it includes 7 local units of government, state agencies, non-governmental organizations. It's a mix like all the previous bills have been. The continued investment in robust ongoing programs constitute 66% of the recommendations, including Cannon River Watershed Habitat Complex, Wild Rice Shoreland Protection, Minnesota Trout Unlimited Cold Water Fish Habitat, and 14% of the programs involve 2 or more entities working in partnership to leverage each other's resources. Investments in public and private conservation partnerships involve 24 programs, which brings over $20 million of leverage into play, or one-fifth. The chart that follows the WHO on page 2 shows acres. The activity goes down, and the biological distinctions go across wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitats. There's a pie chart that ties into the graph for the acres, and there's a pie chart that ties into the bottom chart, which is funds by activity. It breaks out restoration, protect and fee with pilt, protect and fee without pilt, protect and easement, and enhancement. Page 3 is the where does this work, would this work take place? The majority of the activity, 76%, and funding, 69%, would be focused on prairie and prairie transition areas. It supports the goals and objectives of the Minnesota Prairie Plan. 1865 acres of native prairie would be acquired and 2143 acres of native prairie targeted for restoration and enhancement. Forests in the northern and southeastern regions of the state are anticipated to see 20% of activity and 26% of the funds. 3% of the activity goes into the metro urbanizing area, constituting 5% of the funding. And it's important to note that that figure does not include the Conservation Partners Grant Program, which directs $3.692 million to grants in the 7-county metro area. 162 miles of shoreline would be restored, enhanced, and protected. And below the where on page 3, you'll find the charts outlining acres by ecological section and funds by ecological section. And that's the summary.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll walk through the bill with you. Okay. First of all, on page 1, we have, starting in line 1.21, this is the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Of course, the A14 amendment changed the first number under the 2016, so it is now $99,386,000 in fiscal year 2016 and $607,000 in 2017. The subdivision 2 under prairies, this is the first of 5 habitat subdivisions within the bill. 2A is the DNR Wildlife Management Area Scientific Natural Area Acquisition Phase 7. This is for $4.57 million to the commissioner. Commissioner of Natural Resources to acquire land in fee for habitat management purposes, to acquire land in fee for scientific and natural area purposes, with priority given to acquisition of lands that are eligible for native prairie bank, as well as lands adjacent to protected native prairie. 2B is accelerated wildlife management area acquisition phase 7. This is for $7.452 million to the commissioner for an agreement with Pheasants Forever to acquire land in fee for wildlife management area purposes, with priority again given to acquisition of lands that are eligible as native prairie bank and also lands adjacent to protected native prairie. 2C is the Minnesota Prairie Recovery Project Phase 6. It's for $4.032 million to the commissioner for an agreement with Nature Conservancy to acquire native prairie, wetlands, savanna, and restore and enhance grasslands, wetland, and savanna. And again, priority given to those lands eligible for native prairie bank or adjacent to protected native prairie. 2D is the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge Land Acquisition Phase 5 for $3.43 million to the commissioner for an agreement with the Nature Conservancy in cooperation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to acquire lands in fee or permanent conservation easement within the Northern Tallgrass Prairie Habitat Preservation Area in western Minnesota for addition to the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge. 2E is accelerated native prairie bank protection, phase 4, for $3.74 million to the commissioner to implement the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan through the acquisition of permanent conservation easements to protect native prairie and grasslands. Up to $165,000 of this is for establishing and monitoring enforcement funds as approved in the accomplishment plan and subject to Minnesota statute. 2F is the Minnesota buffers for wildlife and water, phase 5, for $4.544 million to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to acquire permanent conservation easement to protect and enhance habitat by expanding the Clean Water Fund riparian buffer program of at least equal benefit to wildlife for buffers on private land. And up to $72,500 of this is for establishing a monitoring and enforcement fund. 2G is the Cannon River Water Headwaters Habitat Complex Phase 5. It's for $1.38 million to the commissioner for an agreement with Trust for Public Lands to acquire and restore lands in the Cannon River watershed for wildlife management purposes. 2H, Prairie Chicken Habitat Partnership for Southern Red River Valley is for $1.8 million to the commissioner for an agreement with Pheasants Forever in cooperation with the Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society to acquire and restore lands in the Southern Red River Valley for wildlife management purposes. 2I is protecting and restoring Minnesota's important bird areas for $1.73 million to the commissioner for agreements to acquire conservation easements within important bird areas identified in the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan and to be used as follows, with $408,000 to Audubon, Minnesota, $1.322 million to the Minnesota Land Trust, of which $100,000 is for establishing monitoring and enforcement funds. 2J is the Wild Rice River Corridor Habitat Restoration for $2.27 million to the commissioner for an agreement with the Wild Rice Watershed District to acquire land in fee and permanent conservation easement and to restore river and related habitat in the Wild Rice River Corridor. 2K is Accelerated Prairie Restoration and Enhancement on DNR Lands Phase 7 for $4.88 million to the commissioner to accelerate the restoration and enhancement of prairie communities on wildlife management areas, scientific and natural areas, state forest lands, and under native prairie bank easements. 2I is Enhanced Public Land Grasslands Phase 2. It's for $1.12 million to the commissioner for an agreement with Pheasants Forever to enhance and restore habitat on public lands. And now we get into the next section, which is Subdivision 3 goes into forests. The first 3A is Camp Ripley Partnership, Phase 5. I should back up. The forest section is for a total of $12,634,000. 3A is Camp Ripley Partnership, Phase 5. It's for $1.5 million to Bowser in cooperation with the Morrison County Soil and Water Conservation District to acquire permanent conservation easements within the boundaries of the Minnesota National Guard compatibility use buffer to protect forest wildlife habitat, and up to $55,000 is for establishment of monitoring and enforcement fund. 3B is Southeast Minnesota Protection and Restoration Phase 3. It's for $2.91 million to the commissioner for an agreement with the Nature Conservancy to acquire land in fee for wildlife management purposes, to acquire land in fee for scientific and natural areas, and for state forest purposes, and to enhance grasslands, forests, and savanna. 3C is Protecting Pinelands, Sands, Aquifer, Forest Lands, Phase 2. That's a mouthful. $2.18 million to the commissioner to acquire forest lands in Cass and Wadena counties for wildlife management purposes and to acquire land in fee for state forests. 3D is the Protect Key Forest Lands in Cass County Phase 6. This is $442,000 to the commissioner for an agreement with Cass County to acquire lands in fee in Cass County for forest wildlife habitat or to prevent forest fragmentation. 3E is Critical Shoreland Protection Program, Phase 3, for $1.69 million to the commissioner for an agreement with Minnesota Land Trust to acquire permanent conservation easements along rivers and lakes in the northern forest region. Up to $222,000 of this is to establish a monitoring and enforcement fund. 3F is the Mississippi Headwaters Habitat Partnership, the A14 amendment changed the $961,000 to $3,002,000. This is to the commissioner to acquire lands at fee and for permanent conservation easements in the Mississippi headwaters, and for agreements as follows: with $1.217 million to the Trust for Public Lands, $824,000 to Minnesota Land Trust, of which $80,000 is for establishing monitoring enforcement fund. 3G is Southeast Minnesota Southeast Forest Habitat Enhancement for $910,000 to the commissioner to enhance forests in southeastern Minnesota. Subdivision 4 starts on page 10, line 10, line 10.7. This is for wetlands for a total of $22,578,000. The first project within that is 4A, accelerating the waterfowl production area acquisition phase 7. This is for $7.62 million to the commissioner for an agreement with Pheasants Forever to acquire land in fee to be designated and managed as waterfowl production areas in Minnesota in cooperation with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. 4B is Living Shallow Lakes and Wetland Initiative Phase 5. This is for $9.04 million to the commissioner for an agreement with Ducks Unlimited to acquire land in fee for wildlife management purposes. 4C, the Wild Rice Shoreland Protection Program Phase 4 is for $131,000 to the commissioner for acquisition of land in fee and $1,469,000 to Bowser to acquire permanent conservation easements on wild rice lake shoreland habitat for native wild rice bed protection. Of this amount, up to $90,000 to Bowser is for establishing monitoring enforcement fund. 4D is accelerated shallow lakes and wetlands enhancement phase 7. This is for $4.318 million to the commissioner to enhance and restore shallow lakes statewide. Subdivision 5, it starts on line 1123. This is for habitats and a total of $22,368,000. 5A is the DNR Aquatic Habitat Phase 7 for $4.54 million to the commissioner to acquire interests in land in fee and permanent conservation easement for aquatic management purposes, and to restore and enhance aquatic habitat. Up to $130,000 of this is for establishing and monitoring enforcement fund. I believe this is also 1131 is where there was an insert from the A14 amendment, sir. 5B is the Metro Big Rivers Phase 6. It's for $2 million to the commissioner for an agreement to acquire land in fee and permanent conservation easement and to restore and enhance natural systems associated with the Mississippi, Minnesota, and St. Croix Rivers as follows: $475,000 to the Minnesota Valley National Wildlife Refuge Trust, Inc., $275,000 to Friends of the Mississippi River, $400,000 to the Great River Greening, $375,000 to Minnesota Land Trust, $475,000 to the Trust for Public Land, with up to $60,000 to Minnesota Land Trust for establishing monitoring and enforcement fund. 5C is the Minnesota Trout Unlimited Cold Water Fish Habitat Enhancement and Restoration Phase. Unlimited Cold Water Fish Habitat Enhancement and Restoration Phase 7. This is for $1.89 million. To the commissioner for an agreement with Minnesota Trout Unlimited to restore and enhance habitat for trout and other species in and along cold water rivers and streams in Minnesota. 5D is Lake Bemidji South Shore Restoration and Enhancement for $1.65 million to the commissioner for an agreement with the city of Bemidji to restore and enhance fish habitat on Lake Bemidji. 5E is the Sandhill River Fish Passage. This is for $990,000 to the commissioner for an agreement with the Sandhill River Watershed District to restore fish habitat in the Sandhill River watershed. 5F is the Shell Rock River Watershed Habitat Restoration Program Phase 4. It's for $2.414 million to the commissioner for an agreement with the Shell Rock River Watershed District to protect, restore, and enhance aquatic habitat in the Shell Rock River watershed. 5G is Lake Nokomis Integrated Habitat Enhancement for $444,000 to the commissioner for an agreement with the Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Board to enhance aquatic habitat on Lake Nokomis. 5H is the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program. This is the statewide and metro habitat, Phase 7. It's for $8.44 million to the commissioner to provide, or for a program to provide competitive matching grants of up to $400,000 to local, regional, statewide, and national organizations to enhance, restore, and protect forests, wetlands, prairies, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife in Minnesota. Of this amount, $3.692 million is for a grant to the 7-county metro area and cities with population of 50,000 or greater. The subdivision 6 is the administrative portion. The 4A amendment made a correction here. Instead of $1.48 million in fiscal year 16 or 2016, it's actually now $585,000. In fiscal year 17, it'll be $607,000. Contract management is $150,000 to the commissioner, $150,000 to the commissioner for contract management duties in this section. The 6B is the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and that is the $608,000 in the first year, $607,000 in the second for administrative expenses of the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council and for compensating the expenses and reimbursements of council members. 6C is Technical Evaluation Panel, $100,000 to the commissioner for a technical evaluation panel to conduct up to 10 restoration evaluations. 6D actually was omitted, so by the 14A amendment, or A14 amendment. Subdivision 7 is availability appropriation. There are a couple things left. Subdivision 8 is the payment conditions and capital equipment expenditures. All agreements administered all agreements are administered on a reimbursement basis, as you mentioned with this, unless otherwise provided in this section. And capital equipment expenditures for specific items in excess of $10,000 must be itemized in and approved as part of the accomplishment plan for each project. Subdivision 9 regards mapping. Subdivision 10, pollinator lethal insecticides. That's your A17 amendment deals with that. But basically, land acquired in fee with money appropriated in this section must not be planted or otherwise treated with a product that contains a pollinator lethal insecticide. Starting on line 1934, or 19.34, is an amendment to, and Mr. Chair, would you like me to go through these amendments?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it's an amendment to statute of 2014, 97A.056, subdivision 2. With the amendment basically starting, the changes are on 21.9 and 21.10, with the removal of old, no longer relevant language, in a nutshell. 21.13 through 21.15 is a shift, shifts the hiring authority of the for Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council nonpartisan staff and contracting with consultants to the LCC, Legislative Coordinating Commission. On line 21.19, this is a start of an amendment to 2014 statute, section 97A.056, subdivision 8. In a nutshell, it adds language ensuring that net proceeds above and beyond land management expenses that are generated from activities on Outdoor Heritage Fund purchased lands must follow the land upon transfer to the state. And I can explain that more if there are questions at whatever time, Mr. Chair.
I'll just continue.
Subdivision 20 on 22.3 deals with donations, and basically it provides light and transparency around potential donations that may be received from the owner of a land while being while those lands are being acquired with Outdoor Heritage Fund monies. On line 22.14, we have another amendment to Minnesota Statute of 14, section 97A.056. This is a grazing and haying, or haying and grazing, clause, subdivision 21. It was put previously into each one of the appropriations. This is adding it into the statute, so it will streamline language. And it A14 amendment adds in changes the last sentence basically so that conservation grazing under a management plan that is being implemented prior to the emergency declaration may continue. So that was an important addition. 22.2 is another amendment to laws of 2012, chapter 264, Article 1, Section 2 to Subdivision 5, and it really is then takes place on page or line 25, 27 on page 25. It's doing two things. First of all, it replaces the term Asian, which is inappropriate for use in this place, and puts in a correct term, invasive, regarding carp. And also on line 2532 and 2533, it includes addition of acquisition terminology to allow acquisition for those cases where it's necessary to construct structural invasive carp deterrence. On page 27, line 2732, this is a an amendment to Minnesota law, chapter 256, article 1, section 2, subdivision 5. And on 28, you'll see the changes. It expands the allowable use of outdoor heritage funds in this appropriation, in this language, to include permanent conservation easements, and directs establishment of a monitoring enforcement fund, which was something that was missed when that. So it gives a little wider latitude in use of the funds in this appropriation. And I believe that concludes the bill, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. This time we'll take questions. And first, I have just making sure now. There's no changes on the open meeting law in this, are there?
Correct, Mr. Chair. There are no changes to the open meeting law on this.
Thank you. Questions? Comments? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, on page 3, lines 3.16 to 3.19 or so, why do they have to, where did the income statements come from and balance sheets for income and expenses? And why them and no one else?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, very good question. The Nature Conservancy has made an interesting overture up front and has stayed with it. In this case, where they're acquiring land in fee, Nature Conservancy will hold the deed on that property, and they will also pay sales or pay their property tax on that property. If there are practices on the property, such as agricultural practices, such as haying or grazing, or gathering native seed, then can be sold. Those are the revenue generating activities upon those lands that have to be reported at the end of each year, as well as what their management costs are, so that all of those dollars are tracked. And to date, just out of interest for this, I checked with Nature Conservancy, and to date they basically are in the red. They're not covering their costs of those properties by this, by these management activities. The reason why it's only in this one is Nature Conservancy will be the only non-government entity holding title to properties. So if there were another non-government entity doing this a similar thing, they would also fall under this this category.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, then the government entities that might have income or expenses from managing their lands, do they not have to report?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm going to look behind me, but I believe the answer is correct. They do not have to report that information. Ms. Coop?
It's just part of their operations. But we can get back to me on that. Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Could we go to page 11? The shallow lakes, $4,318,000. Have those lakes been picked? Or can Mogi Lake be one of them? Mogi Lake in South Hermantown.
And could I throw in Long Lake by Grove City, too?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
I'm willing to share. One north, one south.
Yes.
Yeah. We've been asking DNR to look at Mogi Lake. Well, Jean Miriam came and looked at Mogi Lake. But it was the 1918 fire that created the damage to Mogi Lake and filled it up and is making it a non-trout lake. So,
Mr. Johnson.
Does Mogi Lake have hope, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, Mogi Lake may have hope. With each one of the project, there are parcel listings that go in. So I'm sure within their parcel listings, DNR will have lakes listed. But those parcel listings can be amended to add in or subtract depending on availability and the timeliness. So it may be worth mentioning to DNR if you'd like Mogi Lake to be on that list.
Oh, I've mentioned Mr. Myers knows about Mogi Lake, but I will follow up on that and represent Erdahl.
Long Lake, yes.
Long Lake. Mogi Lake and Long Lake.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the
Mr. Johnson.
In response to your previous question about whether state agencies, my correction, and thanks to Ms. Coop, the under subdivision 8 of 97.8.056, within the revenues section, they are to be reporting those revenues.
Good. Thank you. One more question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Page 28.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, the money when permanent conservation easements are purchased or are in an accomplishment plan, a portion of the money is taken out and put into for establishing a monitoring enforcement fund to make sure that in the future those conservation easements will be monitored, and if there's violation, they will be enforced. In this case, it's that $32,500. And again, I'm really not answering your question with that. I think you probably understand that. The reason for adding in this portion here is that the DNR felt that it was, instead of just acquiring land in this appropriation, it may be more appropriate in instances for them to acquire a permanent conservation easement for the aquatic management purposes, for just accessing. In which case, it would be why hold the land if you don't need to? If you can let the landowner continue to own it and pay the taxes on it, and you can still have working access to your aquatic management. So, DNR had come to us with this request to add this adjustment in language in.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, doesn't DNR have access to the lakes anyway?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, they do have access to the lakes, but in this case it may be
for monitoring?
It may be actually to a stream where it's traveling through private land, and the most appropriate place to put for instance, a structure against invasive species would be where it's totally landlocked by private land. Representative,
Mr. Chair and Representative Mary Murphy.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This allowed for permanent conservation easements to be part of this item that originally didn't have that language in. And part of an OLA report of a couple years ago said that DNR needs to do a better job of monitoring and enforcing their permanent conservation easements. So they're setting up, if there are going to be some permanent conservation easements as part of this $2,560,000, the thoughts are that $32,000 would be established for the monitoring enforcement fund for that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, do you think out of $2 million?
I said it wrong. We better let Ms. Coop come up and fix it.
$2,560,000. Do we really have to pay an additional $32,500 for monitoring?
Mr. Chair.
Identify yourself, please.
Heather Coop, Assistant Director for the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. Representative Murphy, I think we've got a couple of things confused. What this particular appropriation does is it makes a correction to the laws of 2012. When we wrote the appropriation rider language, we failed to include conservation easements as an allowable activity, which was what the council had approved. So it was a mistake on staff's part. And so it was brought to our attention by the department this year, and this change, this makes a change to allow that activity to occur. So this is not anything new. This was included within their proposal. It was included within their accomplishment plan, and it's just making a correction to an error, a staff's error.
And Mr. Murphy. Chair, if that error hadn't been there, you'd still have the $32,500?
Ms. Coop.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm not sure about that, and perhaps Ms. Taylor could speak to that.
Ms. Taylor, would you care to speak to that?
Mr. Chair, members, if I understand the question correctly, the $32,500, that is part of that appropriation, and they would have needed authorization to establish that enforcement account. So without this language, I do not believe they would have been able to establish that account.
It's part of
the
$32,500 is part of the $2,560,000, but I guess if it's up to that amount, so it's coming out of that.
Mr. Chair.
And it always would have come out of that, even if it had been written right in the first place.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy,
if
you'll notice throughout the entire bill, any appropriation recommendation that includes conservation the easements, there will be a similar phraseology there that directs up to a certain amount to be set aside for use, for specific use only for the enforcement and monitoring of those conservation easements acquired under that particular appropriation.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Coop, then.
Representative Murphy.
When there's an up to amount, then are we limiting the amount of monitoring that can be done for an area, and maybe they're not getting enough monitoring by the up to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is an amount that is put forward by the applicant, so they have determination. Each, whether it's a nonprofit or a state entity, they have a methodology to calculate the amount that they anticipate they will need over the course of a lifetime of an easement to monitor and enforce that easement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Other questions? Yes, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations, Ms. Kingston, on your election. I think you're vice chair. Congratulations, and congratulations, Mr. Johnson, on your position. I thought it was good questioning on that those numbers. That was interesting to me. It was a little embarrassing. I was looking on page 9, and one of them really jumped out at me because it was the Critical Shoreline Protection Program, and it's a $1.7 million item, and then $220,000 of that is in that category that you're establishing and monitoring, which seems, I had my trusty friend here, it's about 14-15%. It just seems a little high, you know, for monitoring, but, you know, it's up to again, so I know we're going through that. But anyways, I'm sure you're giving this due consideration and thought through the process. So I just have a couple questions. I'm just curious how the conservation grazing that you mentioned, how have you found that to be working? Is that successful? I know that was somewhat controversial. There's some people that didn't think it would work. I thought it was pretty neat that you could bring cattle on and eat some of the bad stuff, but I was told that was bad science apparently or something. But I'm glad that you're still doing it. I'm just curious, is it working? Obviously, it must be, or you wouldn't be continuing to fund it.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, it is a tool in the toolbox for management of grasslands and potentially prairies, but especially grasslands. So as I understand, there is some benefit to it, yes. Especially if it's done right, and that's the key, is making sure it's done right.
Ms. Kingsman?
Thank you. Jane Kingston speaking. The hang and grazing are employed to replicate buffalo and fire, and you can't control either one of those very well. Hang and grazing comes very close, and you realize some of those same benefits. And the organizations that are using those do it very judiciously.
Representative Lilly?
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's good to hear. I just kind of going through your bill, I saw some ducks unlimited. You're trying to do some restoration on some projects on that. I continue to support that. I know you had some success draining a lake. I want to continue my pledge to, or request to have you send some of that water to the East Metro, to White Bear Lake. We could use that when you're shipping it next time, so keep that in mind. So finally, on over the weekend, I was reading some articles, and so I just want your opinion as what you're going to do with the North Woods. It's not related to this bill, but it's certainly related to your committee. It's under the jurisdiction of this legacy committee, and it's one third of our budget goes to your projects. And I'm just curious how you're going to wiggle your way out. It's a kind of a tricky little worm, I know, and I don't know what the commission feels about it versus us politicians, because it's a I know it's tricky. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, the council did have a good discussion on Friday about that proposal. They did come forward. Crow Wing County did, more as an FYI to let us know that they've been approached by some folks interested in establishing how many of the miles of ATV trails on Mississippi Northwoods would be open to ATV use. Representative Lilly, if I'm not mistaken, you and I were the House members on Lessard Sam's when this bill passed us. For the most part, I think the members on the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council were surprised that this land is a county forest. As you know, the state gave it to Crow Wing County. Crow Wing County is a county located south of Highway 2, but it is a county that has a county policy in place which state law allows that county can be a county that is open unless marked closed for their ATV trails, even though state law says if you're south of Highway 2, your ATV trails are closed unless marked open. Crow Wing County has a policy that their ATV trails are open unless marked closed. So the bottom line is the day after we acquired the property on Mississippi Northwoods, 24 miles of ATV trails were open to the public. And that's where we're at now. Crow Wing County has come forward with a proposal to begin a consideration that some of the 24 miles would be closed. I think you could interpret that to mean that some of them would be open. That's arguably not consistent with normal practices of buying land in Lessard Sam's. Now, that's not totally true. Lessard Sam's has bought a lot of land that is open, for sure, easements that and land, arguably, if we acquire forest land north of Highway 2, standard procedures in state and county forests is there, a multi-use land purchase with trails. The Blandon acquisition of 186,000 acres for easements, I think, clearly has ATV use within some of that land, if I'm not mistaken. So, actually, there's a good relationship, I think, potentially between the Crow Wing County and the state as we work through a really tough issue. So I'm not exactly sure where it's all going to go, but it makes Lessard Sam's Council, I think, know the importance of properly vetting projects in the council.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, and thank you for the honest discussion. I just love the land, so I'm completely biased, and I think what a treasure that we were able to save it. And and I respect that it's complicated and those sort of things, and I know we're in a political building and that sort of thing, but it I don't know how, you know, it's going to be it is kind of a can of worms with that one in particular, but I'm so glad we acquired it and that it's in our state possession, and I hope that we can work it out. The reason I bring it up, and it may sound like, you know, it's just not related, but it's very much related to our today's discussion with Representative Green's, I feel, because of when we bought it, and you were pretty clear that you thought that this was going to happen. I mean, and you proved to be right. You know, and I was more, let's get it and figure it out. And so in defense, or in credit to you, you were probably more right, but I feel right that I'm glad we have it. Now let's work it out. But it's kind of related to, you know, the intent, at least how I see Representative Green's bill, is when we buy stuff and then, you know, are they honest to us, or is it, you know, that's a strong word, but, you know, is, you know, the agreements, are they agreements, and how do they all pan out? So, I mean, this is just one property. It's a big one, but it, I would imagine these discussions and complications are on many of our parcels that we work with. But thank you for the discussion, and I really don't mean, I don't have a political thing in it. I like the land, and I hope we can figure it out.
Ms. Kingston.
Well, I'd like to throw in my 2 cents worth, if I could, and try to keep it short. I know that Representative Lilly and his son were on the same tour when we went and looked and put our feet on the ground up there, and it is an outstanding piece of property. There's no doubt about it. And if I remember, you have some family history nearby at a camp that where you've gone for many, many years, and your family has. And, you know, it resonates with a lot of people on a lot of different levels. And I am somewhat duly chastised because I didn't know to ask, are any of your rules contrary to what DNR does? I didn't ask that question. And, you know, I'm learning as I go, and I hope to get better and better all the time. But to his credit, Representative McNamara did grill him pretty hard, and that never did come out. And I think that you'd agree, when we went on that tour, there were lots of visual aids, there were lots of maps and overheads that showed where they anticipated roads and trails, and none of them showed what we're being presented now. But I take comfort in the fact that what they're presenting now is a proposal. It is not a foregone conclusion, and I'm really optimistic that we've got to work out something to the best, because I don't want to cut out any of the possible partners that might come forward to qualify for these funds. I don't want it to become a lock for any one entity. I think that the more people that are involved in conservation statewide, the better. So I hope we can cure it.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Kingsman, I agree. And just one real brief thing. I just hope that you, as you consider what you're going to do with this can of worms, that you consider the mobily challenged folks in our society and just figure out ways that they can get access to the land. So that's all I just want to thank you.
Representative Pinesman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Lilly's comment, I really appreciate the context of folks that are challenged in their access to the property. There's been a lot said over the last few days about this project in my county, and I'd like to stress and emphasize that this is going to allow, and this is a long-standing open unless posted close position of the county. And I agree, to Representative McNamara's credit, he saw that there could be some issues with this going forward. But I also would like to just be on the record as saying I'm very grateful that Lessard Sams did make the purchase. I'm very grateful that the property is now in the possession of the state, and that it is accessible, and that it is preserved. Some people might differ in their agreement or disagreement with its potential use going forward. But it is a great benefit and asset to an area that is trying to include everybody, whether you're boating, skiing, walking, bicycling, or operating an ATV. And as you know, millions of them are out there, and people want to be able to use them. And I'm not saying they're all going to be used in one place, but it is nice that it is inclusive and that people have access.
Ms. Kingston.
I'll try to keep it short. access was something we did talk about, particularly for people who are disabled in any way. That is something that was on the record from 2 years ago, and that is something that we contemplated. I think that all of the counselors that were there would agree with that. But there's one thing that we have to keep in mind, is that what we buy with, what the legislature buys, we don't buy it with Outdoor Heritage funds. It's for habitat, not for recreation. So there is a distinction there that we always have to keep present in our minds. But to your point about accessibility, for people who have limited access, that was discussed, and we did intend to go that way.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like to talk about an item that was taken out of the bill that came from the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Fund, and then it was taken out of the bill. Is this the proper time to do this? I do have an amendment.
Representative Kahn, why don't you do it under your amendment?
Okay. Well, all right.
Any other comments or questions right now, or we can proceed to the A-17 amendment and then to the A-18, except that Josh Heinzman has a question. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is on page 22, lines 22.16 through line 22.19. And what I'm wondering is why the change in regard to emergency haying and grazing.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, in the past, this clause has gone into each individual appropriation. It adds to a longer bill. It adds to basically some confusion in some sorts. By people saying, well, why is it in that appropriation and not this one? And part of that answer is because in some situations, haying and grazing may be pertinent for a management plan on those properties. In this case, it allows the, if we put it into the statute, then it allows that we don't have to put it into each individual project. It'll just have its applicability as we go forward. Does that answer your question, sir?
Representative Heinzman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, so I guess the question then would be, it's a simplification, that makes sense. Would there be cases like what you had just mentioned where it would be applicable and then it might be added to the language to allow for it where it might be a benefit to a community?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, haying and grazing is an allowable management plan, an allowable part of a management plan for grasslands and so on. So this will not restrict a future management of a property utilizing haying and grazing, as long as it's as long as that activity is in the management plan before an emergency grazing and haying termination comes out.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, what this Subdivision 21 is about, it's been a pet peeve of Representative Hansen's and mine that it seems like every year there's an emergency declaration because it's too wet, too dry, too hot, too cold, and there's emergency grazing and haying going on. And what this says is that you can't do that on lands acquired with Outdoor Heritage funds because they're supposed to be protected. But you can hay and graze it as part of a management plan. So there's a real limited where they'll open wildlife management areas to haying and grazing. Correct me if I'm wrong, Director Johnson, but this would not allow lands that have been bought with Outdoor Heritage to be emergency hay and graze like other WMA could that were purchased by different monies.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, with the one caveat that if it is in the management
right.
plan, correct?
Okay. If there are no other questions now, we'll proceed back to the amendment that entered and then withdrew. Representative McNamara, would you like it reintroduced?
Please. And then I would like to speak to the letter and to the amendment.
All right, then. I will move... That A-17 be adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the 817, the letter from Pollinate, Minnesota, talks mostly about the need to be conscious of not having neonicotinoid plants planted that are going to kill bees when they're planted.
Wow.
My amendment, because it was so broad, the original adoption is so broad, it would stop the planting of certain crops that would be used temporarily to prepare the land to properly plant it with prairie plants, such as corn seeds coated with a neonicotinoid, and bees don't eat corn, so it's not going to kill the bees. That's not the issue here. The amendment will make it more practical to be able to properly prepare the land so that it would be planted and not hurt and actually help pollinators. So that's the.
So this is a good pollinator amendment.
What? No. Mr. Chair, that is up to interpretation. I would say that it helps in the case that it properly prepares the land, and you could argue that you could go out and hand pull the weeds or whatever, too, if you weren't using that certain kind of corn seed.
Kind of like when I said a morning dove season was good for the morning doves.
I'm not going there, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kahn.
I'm not sure there are any circumstances where pollinator-lethal insecticides are a good idea. And I thought this language in the bill controlled it, and it's real hard to see what's the advantage in taking it out. There are other crops that can be used. Just all you have to do is just any organic farmer, for example, is planting crops that do not use those. So it's not a question of that they're not, you can't use a crop to, there isn't a crop to prepare the land, you know, for this usage. And again, it's not, we're not talking about the general farmland of the state. We're talking about the farmland that's subject to the legacy constitutional amendment. So I think this is a bad amendment, and I hope we'll vote no against it.
Further discussion? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, if we adopt A-17, then will we just be assuming that the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Outdoor Heritage Board doesn't care about pollinators? Because they won't be mentioned anywhere.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mary Murphy, this language was added in Environment Committee. It did not come as a recommendation from the council, and Representative Hansen added in our Environment Committee, not when he was a member of the council. So, and this land is subject to all the current language in law about limitations on neonicotinoids. In current nursery law, it's still subjected to all the provisions of Section 18 in law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
I listened to Vice Chair Kingston.
Yes, ma'am.
Kingston talk about how the legislature appropriates the money and the legislature ultimately makes the recommendations of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And I think that if a committee of Environment Committee made the decision to think that pollinators were very important to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, that we should leave the language in, because The Environment Committee is a committee of the legislature. At the first meeting when Mr. Johnson talked to us about this, he said that the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the board made their recommendations to the legislature, and then at that point, then the legislature picks it up. And I think that we should take the Outdoor Heritage Board's recommendations and what they have submitted to us that has gone to the Environment Committee and what they added into it, and we should continue the process of doing the work of the legislature in the Legacy Committee and add our approval to those two, to the process that's taken us to this point. So I think we should keep it in.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, I will renew the motion to approve of A17. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Here's not a, is adopted. Yes. Did I say that wrong? I got it right. Continuing. Next, we have the amendment A14. A15, Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I presented this amendment, and it actually comes in an appropriate place following the vote on the last one, which is what this amendment, the A15 amendment, would do would be to restore language that was in the original LaSard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council project protecting wildlife habitat in the Wild Rice River watershed. This is to the White Earth Nation. I don't know if there are people from the White Earth Nation still here. I know they were here earlier today. Yes, okay, yes. I guess, yeah. So there are people then to testify to this. But one of the points is that, you know, some of you who were here a couple of years ago may have remembered, I got into an enormous amount of trouble because I altered some words in the LaSard-Sams Outdoor Heritage approval. I got, I think it is a world record of 9 negative editorials from the esteemed Dennis Anderson, and I challenge anyone in the future to exceed that. And I was also subject to the projects that, I mean, the committee had put in, but that, and, you know, there are members on the committee who were very helpful in putting those in.
We kept trying to help you, Representative Kahn.
I know. That the committee had put in was subject to only one of two line item vetoes from Governor Dayton, vetoed both of them even after a promise to not doing it. So it was kind of a, that was kind of a surprise. But so, you know, I thought the lesson that we got was that we upheld LSO, OFC language. So on this one, when we're now trying to take something out instead of insert something in, the council rated 45 projects in total, and only 15 of those 45 got higher ratings than this White Earth project. So it was rated way above the median of all the LSOHC projects. You know, Representative McNamara, the author of the bill, rated that very highly. And in fact, he even wanted to fully fund it, and that was one of, that was actually a minority position on the council. But the idea that this piece of land is extremely important to keep on the tax rolls doesn't really stand up. The pilt on this project, and some of us are working on trying to pay pilt, an issue to pay pilt on legacy projects, but it's $12,000. That's hardly anything in terms of what a state budget looks at. The White Earth Band went through the process. The citizens and legislators researched LSOHC researched the project. White Earth Band testified. In the end, they recommended to the legislature that we fund this project. And it's a good project, and unfortunate that the majority
of opposition we've seen seems to either be racist against a white earth band, or it's not wanting the white earth band to protect their God-given freedom of religion. And these are taxpayers who contribute to legacy funds, and we think it's unfair to exclude them from this process. And so anyway, I'd like someone representing the White Earth Band here, and I'd like them to testify on this.
Well, thank you, Representative Kahn. I believe that Mr. Hodges is there. Representative McNamara?
Well, thank you, and Representative Kahn, you are right that I did recommend fully funding the project. And as part of the public record also, we're a very transparent organization, as the chair has already mentioned, and wondered if there was any open meeting law changes proposed. But part of the public record are my notes, and my notes are only if the state of the Minnesota is the fee holder of the land. For all the discussion we've already had about the challenges when we buy significant property and have a different entity own it other than the state of Minnesota, I did fully fund the project, but under the understanding that only if the state of Minnesota was the fee holder of the land.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I'll also point out that with the great difficulties that I and the committee, should not pretend that it's me alone, although I seem to get pointed out for a lot of personal negatives, same arguments were made on the Leech Lake project, which was one of the ones that actually, that was not line item vetoed by the governor. That one we didn't get through the conference committee with the Senate. But it was kind of interesting that the next year, all of those projects were sort of done without any fuss at all. So I don't quite know what happened to that, but it's, I would certainly, so I don't know if we're going to go through that again. I would much prefer to see this funded this year. But maybe we can hear from Mr. Haas. Always nice to have a former legislator from the opposite political party testifying on the same side I am.
Well, thank you, Representative Kahn. Mr. Haas, you're very toned down in your shirt today.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I just didn't wear a bright shirt today. But I still have that picture of the shirts of Haas from the House floor that the House photographer took. That's framed in my office, so I look at it quite often. I still wear some of those shirts.
For those who aren't aware of it, former Representative Haas was known for his colorful shirts when he served in the House of Representatives. So, identify yourself, please, then proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Bill Haas. I represent White Earth Tribal Nation. And this project was in the Lasard Sams. It vetted through the process. And what this project does, and it's important to White Earth, is the fact that it protects their main wild rice lake, which produces about 200,000 pounds of wild rice, which equates to about $1.2 million in revenue to the tribe and to the band members who harvest on this lake. And it's important because a lot of these people, that is their subsistence for the year, is wild ricey. In fact, it was interesting, I didn't know this until I was talking to Representative Purcell, but back in the late 70s, there was a chicken farm upriver, and they had manure pits, and the manure pits leaked into the river, and it killed all the wild rice in this lake. And it was Representative Purcell was in charge of the watershed at the time, and his duty was to clean up the river and then restore the wild rice to that lake. And that was successfully done, and the lake is in wild rice production. And it's quite impressive when you go see this lake, and it's just covered with wild rice every year. And it's a great opportunity for people to earn income up in northern Minnesota. And it provides revenue streams for businesses up there where they spend their money. But White Earth would own and manage this land. The DNR does not want this land. It's owned by Potlatch currently. We do not want this to be sold into parcels. There's 6,500 feet of river that we want to protect with this purchase, so that we don't have pollution problems. We don't have to go through another disaster with this rice crop. one of the questions that came up is the fact that ownership of the land. The land would be held in trust through the United States government. If at any time in the future, White Earth says, we do not want to manage this land, then it would revert back to the DNR. So it's they're not going to lose. Hunting and fishing is another issue. There are no restrictions put on this land by White Earth for hunting and fishing. It is open to band members. It's open to the general public to go up there and hunt and fish on this land. They will follow the same rules that the DNR puts out, and White Earth does follow those. If at any time in the future a council would say we don't want to allow hunting on this land, the land would automatically revert back to the state of Minnesota, because it's, these are all protective covenants that are put into the agreement that is going to be between the DNR and White Earth, and they've already agreed to those covenants. So this land is important. We don't, you know, up there, up in northern Minnesota right now, there is forest land being cleared for potato farms. We're preserving this land so it doesn't go into potato farms or cross or cropland. It's going to be managed for the wildlife. White Earth Conservation Department will work, and they've worked in the years past, and we've partnered with the DNR on other projects up there and been very successful. But we will be partnering with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the DNR, and White Earth will work together to manage this land and keep it in trust for the people of Minnesota to enjoy for hunting and fishing, and then protect the resource for band members to harvest wild rice on it. It's also an excellent duck hunting lake that people would have access to after the rice is gone.
Further discussion? Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like a roll call vote on this amendment.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify that when I did, when I brought this forth in the Environmental Committee, the issue is not White Earth at all. And if you want to debate that, we can debate that here today. But the issue is the fact that this is a small county. It's already 37% publicly owned. And they can't. They have signed a no net. I don't know if it's no net gain, no net loss. However you pronounce it, that they can't afford to lose any more property inside their county, and that's what this is about. And this is going to drive up the property taxes for members and non-members, because there are those of us who are members of White Earth who own our own land and we pay our property taxes. If you're renting in that county, your rent is going to go up. $12,000 may not be a lot for the state, but it's a considerable amount for a small, poor county. And so I'm against this amendment.
Representative Kahn?
Well, there are multiple other cases of land being acquired in this bill through this. As I said, there are members of the legislature interested in working on the PILT issue and making sure that legacy-acquired lands will pay the appropriate PILT, PILT funding. How many, excuse my ignorance, but how many people live in the county that we're concerned about?
Are you asking?
The population. I guess if anyone who knows.
Representative Green?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I don't know the exact number that live in the county, but is it relevant?
What?
Is it relevant? How many people
yes.
live in the county? Why? Why would it be relevant how many people live in the county? They're still paying taxes there.
It's just a piece of information.
Representative Kahn?
It's just a piece of information that I would like. If there were 3,000, we're looking at a payment of $4 a year, something like that. I mean, I like to, my background likes me to put everything in the proper mathematical format. So I'm just interested in that. I'm sorry I didn't look it up and know it myself, but
which
if anyone
county?
Knows it, I would like to know.
Mr. Chair, that's Clearwater County.
Does anyone know what the population of
we're working on that.
Oh, okay. Well,
8,838.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg.
So is that $1.50 then per person?
Okay. Mr. Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment to that. One of the partnerships White Earth has just completed with the Department of Human Services is we transferred all the human service functions from Mahnomen, Becker, and Clearwater County to White Earth. That is a substantial savings to all three of those counties. So we have actually help them in lowering the expenses of those counties because they no longer have to pay for tribal members in any form of human services functions. So, yes, we recognize the fact it's $12,000, but we have saved them a considerable amount of money to the taxpayers of that community.
Representative McNamara, did you...
No, I'm good.
You're good, okay. Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing none?
Well, you know, I just want to make the points again. This is, if PILT is the only reason, we're looking at $1.50 per person. That's kind of like, that's not even the cup of a serious Starbucks coffee. That's like the cup of the price of a regular cup of coffee that people can give up once a year to do this. Maybe it was just an attack on me and not an attack, a personal attack on me and not an attack on the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage process last year.
But I don't think that could be true.
I took that lesson seriously. And so, for example, when we did fund those projects, they ended up coming through the LSOHC. And so I think this, you know, for the members that weren't here, as I said, that was probably the most, I've done a lot of different things in the legislature, that was probably the most flack I've gotten on anything, plus the most amount of negative press I've ever gotten on anything. So I don't understand why we want to repeat doing that again this year.
So Representative Kahn, you're trying to protect the current chair.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. I hope so. it's just that supposedly changing something was considered, as I said, 9 negative editorials, a world record. So I think I would suggest that we vote yes on my amendment and put this back into the bill and protect the chair and protect the members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Any other discussion? Seeing none, we will proceed to the roll call vote.
Representative Erdahl?
No.
Representative Heinzman?
No.
Representative Daniels? Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Kahn?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative Miller?
No.
Representative Murphy, E?
Yes.
Representative Murphy, M?
Yes.
Representative Torkelson?
No.
Representative Wills?
No.
Being 7 no votes and 5 yes votes, the motion fails. The amendment fails. Any further discussion on the bill? Anyone from the public care to comment on the bill? Seeing none, it will then be as amended, laid over for possible inclusion in the legacy omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Any further business to come before us? Seeing none, well, King, this case is closed.